for developing the virus in the first place, Archibald Holmes for recruiting her, her husband for rejecting her, Jack for being weak, and humans for being venal. Blaze sucked noisily through his straw, dragging up the last of the coke.
Boy, this is really heavy, you know?
She's beautiful, isn't she?
Fleur?
A shrug.
Yes, I guess.
I have to see her, Blaise. Explain, set the past straight. Have her forgive me.
Why should you care?
Burning sky. Look at the time. I was supposed to meet the Texas delegation 5 minutes ago. Go buy some dinner, put it on the room, and stay out of trouble. I've got to change. The phone was ringing as he entered the room. Snatching it up, Tachyon heard the hiss of long distance. An operator's cool, bored tone said,
"Will you accept the call from Mr. Thomas Downs?"
For an instant, disbelief at the journalist's brass held him silent, and Tack could hear faint and far away Digger babbling frantically.
"Tacky, you gotta listen! Sir, this call has not yet been accepted."
Admonishment from a frigid operator.
"Tacky, listen, something Sir, help me! Sir, will you accept the charges?"
"In big trouble!" Digger's voice soared into the soprano range. "No." Tachyon slammed on the phone so hard that it gave a ring of protest. He was halfway out of his shirt when it rang again.
"Collect call."
"No." It rang 7 more times. After the 3rd time, Tack stopped answering. The shrill ringing was a drill biting into his head. He dressed quickly in his usual elaborate finery, pale rose and lavender with silver lace. The phone was still ringing as he stepped into the hall. For a moment, he hesitated.
"Help me."
"Help him how?" Tack gave his head an emphatic shake, pulled the door shut. Too often Digger had embroiled him in the sleazy journalist's sleazy little problems. Not this time. I have enough problems of my own.
Spectre hadn't been to the store for 1.5 years. Not since the wildcard day when the astronomer went out in a blaze of glory. With a little help from him, of course. The suit he'd bought then didn't last out the day. But then a lot of things hadn't made it through that day. The old guy who ran the place had seemed okay to him. What the hell? Might as well throw him some more business. He couldn't stay at a swank hotel and not have some decent clothes. He'd stand out like a joker at a fashion show. He knew it was a mistake as soon as he stepped in. Before, the store had been old, dim, and dusty, like the old man who ran it. Now the place had been repainted, and new, brighter lighting had been put in. The room even smelled new. As Spectre turned to leave, a voice called out to him. "Hey, come on in, sir. If you're looking for fine clothing at great prices, you've come to the right place. Just tell me. I'm Bob. Name's on the sign outside. What you want, and I'll fix you up in no time." Spectre looked Bob over. He was dressed well enough, although the clothes didn't disguise the fact he was creeping into middle age. But he had a hustler's eyes and smile. Spectre just wanted to buy some clothes and get out. "I'll need 2 suits. One dark gray and 1 light gray. 38 long. Not too expensive." Bob stroked his chin and made a face. "I don't think gray is really your color. Something into tan, maybe. Come on over here." He grabbed Spectre by the elbow and guided him over to one of the mirrors. "Wait just a second." Spectre looked around the store. He didn't see anyone else. It was just Bob and him. Bob trotted back over, holding a tan coat. He turned Spectre toward the mirror and held the coat up in front of him. "What do you think? Great, huh? And a steal at $450. Plus alterations, of course." "I want 2 suits, just like I said. 1 light gray, 1 dark gray." Bob sighed. "Look around outside. You know how many people are wearing gray suits? If you want to stand out, make an impression, you have to dress for it. Trust me." Spectre wasn't listening. He was breathing evenly and concentrating, remembering the pain, the agony of his own death. You okay, mister? Spectre turned to face Bob and stared into the man's eyes. They linked. Bob couldn't look away, and Spectre didn't want to. The memory of his death blotted out everything else, and he gave it to the man in front of him. His insides twisted and burned. Skin ruptured and sloughed off. Muscles tore and bones snapped. Spectre's death lived again in his mind. And Bob felt it, too. Spectre shuddered as he recalled his heart bursting. Bob gasped. His legs went rubbery, and he fell over, dead. Just as Spectre had been, before Tachyon brought him back to life. Spectre glanced around. They were still alone. He grabbed Bob under the armpits and dragged him into one of the dressing booths, then walked back to the rack and picked out two gray suits, one dark and one light. He wrapped them in plastic and headed for the street. The customer's always right, Bob. First rule of business.
9 p.m. The problem with Jackson on the ticket is that it could cost us the election. I mean, not to sound bigoted or nothing.
But you do, interrupted Tachyon. A frown of Jovian proportions creased Bruce Jenkins' forehead. Since the only hair remaining to the man was a tiny ruff over each big red ear, it looked as if his entire head was buckling like earthquake-torn earth.
Not to suggest that you are, Tachyon hastened to add, realizing that Takesian tactlessness might not be in place at a political convention. But why are we discussing third-place runners, no matter how interesting or charismatic? The real issue is Senator Hartman and Lior Barnett.
Reverend!
Eh?
Reverend Barnett, you give Hartman his title, Leo's deserving of his too.
Are we finally getting down to business, Mr. Jenkins?
Yeah, Texas went solidly for the Reverend.
And you intend to keep it that way?
If I can. Now, this ain't to say that Greg Hartman isn't a good man. He is. That's why I think a Barnett-Hartman ticket might have some real strengths.
Impossible.
Now, don't be so hasty. Politics is a lot like horse trading, Doctor. You can't be too rigid.
Mr. Jenkins, if the issue is the triumph of the Democratic ticket in November, then a ticket headed by Lior Barnett would be a disaster. There are still enough people who would oppose a religious figure running this country. Besides, Barnett is a one-note candidate.
No, sir, there you're wrong. You see him as a one-note candidate because you're obsessed with wild cards, but Leo speaks for a lot of simple Americans who are worried about the moral decay of this country.
They stepped out of the Bellomondo restaurant. To their left came the clatter of cutlery on china as the journalists, hangers-on, and less wealthy delegates dined in the Marriott's coffee shop. Tachyon frowned up at the banners stretched across the dizzying expanse of the lobby atrium. Heard the sharp tick of high heels, jumped and whirled as he felt cold fingers nuzzle up beneath his hair, touching the nape of his neck. Sarah winced at the pressure of his hand around her fingers. Bright color flamed in each cheek, but it looked angry against the unnatural white of her skin.
I came for a statement and to see if I could help.
Tachyon shook his head.
What?
She reared back slightly, nostrils flaring.
Chrysalis.
What about her?
She's dead.
The flat tone snapped him around as surely as Fleur's slap. He took two quick steps, groping for support. His hand closed on the sharp point of Sarah's shoulder.
Dead? You mean you didn't know?
No, I've been busy all day.
Yeah.
Her tone was bitter, and then abruptly she dropped a gentle, sympathetic mask over her pale features.
I'm sorry to be the one to tell you.
Jenkins tiptoed over.
Doctor, it seems you've had bad news. We'll talk another time.
Sarah gripped Tachyon's arm with both hands and tugged him toward the elevators.
This has been a shock. You're very pale. Maybe you should lie down.
I need a drink. Sarah hung on grimly to his arm.
Don't you have something in your room?
He frowned at her. Yes.
Let's go there.
Pale tongue running briefly across those two thin lips.
I need to talk to you.
Physical vertigo added to his emotional vertigo as the elevator shot upward.
Chrysalis, he shook his head.
Tell me.
She did. In quick, terse sentences, her pale eyes locked on his lilac ones. She seemed to be pressing for a mind contact, and he tightened his control. He didn't really want to know what went on behind that intense face. He led them into the suite, stood staring at the mirror over the wet bar, a hand closed limply about a brandy bottle.
Mirrors. Chrysalis had loved mirrors, and had filled her boudoir with them.
He pictured the skull head with its trademark swirl of glitter on one transparent cheek, pictured it battered to a bloody pulp. The tink of glass on glass was loud in the room. He turned and held out the glass, but Sarah was gone. Hearing the squeak of a mattress, he walked into the bedroom and stared in bewilderment at her pose, elbows resting on the coverlet, one leg cocked over the other, skirt hiked to mid-thigh. She accepted the drink and coyly patted the bed next to her. Feeling like a man sharing a bench with a spider, he sank wearily down.
Secrets, he sighed and drank. I suppose Chrysalis at last found the secret that killed her.
Yes. Sarah stared rigidly at the far wall, gave a shake, and placed her hand on his arm. It lay there, heavy and lifeless.
I know how much this must hurt you. You two were very close.
He removed her hand, squeezed it, and set it aside.
I don't know if I would go that far.
The hand crept back, fingers tightening suddenly on the big muscle in his thigh. She began to rub him. Tack rolled a nervous eye in her direction. Sweat had broken along her hairline, and her lips were compressed into a thin line. She sensed his scrutiny and smiled at him, eyelids half lowered, pouted her lips. Tachyon drained his glass. His leg muscle was beginning to cramp under her furious assault.
Another?
He waved the glass. Throaty, husky.
Oh, yes, please.
They sat drinking in silence. Tachyon felt his guts cramping.
I wonder. Jesus.
He hit the edge of the bed, slid off onto the floor, brandy sloshing across his crotch, thrust his little finger into his ear, and wiped out the moisture left by the sudden thrust of Sarah's tongue. It had felt like someone driving a Q-tip dipped in icy Vaseline into his ear. She hung over the bed, staring down at him with fever-bright eyes, gasped out,
I want you, I want you.
It was like getting hit with a rake, bony knees, elbows, pelvis digging into his chest, groin, thighs as she flung herself upon him. They thrashed for a few moments, Sarah dropping inexpert kisses onto whatever part of his anatomy she could hit. Tachyon threw her off and tottered to the far side of the bed.
What in the hell are you doing?
Tears of shame and rage filled his eyes.
I want to make love with you.
If this is some kind of joke, it is in pretty goddamn bad taste. Or actually, it's in perfect taste if you go in for cruel Tachyon humor.
What are you driveling about?
She screamed, raking back her hair.
I'm impotent, impotent, impotent!
Still?
Honest amazement filled the word. It shredded his last vestige of control.
Yes, fuck you! Now get out! Just get the hell out of here!
Blotchy red patches flamed in her cheeks. Sarah flung herself on his chest, hands clasped frenziedly behind his neck.
No, please. I can't leave you. I'm next, don't you see? Only you can keep me safe.
Are you out of your mind? Keep you safe from what?
Hartman! Hartman! He killed Andy, he killed Chrysalis, and now he's going to kill me.
I am not going to listen to any more of this.
He is a monster, inhuman, evil.
A year ago you were fucking your brains out with him.
Her breath came in harsh pants.
He
made me.
Oh, now I've heard everything. You are crazy.
Tack threw himself through the sitting room, dragging Sarah like a recalcitrant foal, flung open the door. Out, 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 out! She ran from him and threw herself onto the bed, curled up with a pillow clutched to her chest.
No, no, you can't make me. I won't leave. You've got to help me.
She wailed as he bundled her into his arms and staggered back to the door.
Read me. Go into my mind,
she hissed, clinging to his lapels.
I wouldn't touch that cesspool that you call a mind.
Fire flared as her nails raked across his face.
When I'm dead, you'll be sorry.
I'm already sorry.
Tack slammed the door, brushed distastefully at his coat, and crossed to the bar. Seized the cognac and drank directly from the bottle, spewed as the heat became too much for his throat. He drew a hand across his face and yelped as the liquor entered the cuts left by her nails.
Help me. You don't want to believe. When I'm dead, you'll be sorry.
The bottle exploded against the far wall.
I am tired of feeling sorry.
11 p.m. Spectre combed his hair up and went at the ends with the scissors. Lank brown strands fell into the dirty sink. The job was near barber standards. He'd cut hair on the side when working his way through school and had gotten pretty good at it. He picked up the cracked hand mirror and checked the neckline in the back. Not bad, my man, he said to himself. He scooped up a fingerful of skin lotion and rubbed it onto his reddened upper lip. Without the mustache and long hair, he looked years younger, not much different from his old college self. Only the pained eyes were forever changed. With his hair washed and blown dry, he'd be unrecognizable to anyone who'd met him since he became Demise. Except Tachyon. He'd know regardless. The thought of the little alien knocked him from his normal sullen mood into a gnawing rage. Making the hit, that would hurt Tachyon. He nodded to the mirror and walked into the living room. The decor was nicer than his apartment in Jokertown. The walls were gray-green. The furnishings were mahogany or other dark woods. He even picked up occasionally. He'd made the move back to Teaneck after the sleeper had roughed him up. Considering the hell that had broken loose not long after, it had been a good idea. He flopped into the black futon and reached for the TV remote control. His flight wasn't until 10 the next day. There would be plenty of time to pack in the morning. He punched up WABC. The set crackled to life and Ted Koppel came into view. Little was known about this woman with transparent skin, who chose to create her own kingdom in the center of New York City's Jokertown. Koppel's brows were knit together even more tightly than usual. While police are saying little about the apparent murder, it was seemingly a very brutal affair. There is the possibility that an ace with abnormal strength was involved. Before giving you what limited background we have on this woman named Chrysalis, here's what Angela Ellis, captain of the Jokertown precinct, had to say earlier today. The video cut to a drab press area. A short woman with dark hair and green eyes stood in front of a nest of microphones. She coughed, then paused, and placed her hands palms down on the podium. The woman, popularly known as Chrysalis, was found dead at her place of business this morning. Should the medical examiner determine that a homicide has occurred, this office will, of course, conduct a thorough investigation. We have no further information to give at this time. Voices of questioning reporters immediately rose into a roar. Ellis raised one hand.
That's it. We'll keep you informed as facts become available.
Spectre reached for the bottle of whiskey he always kept by the futon. He twisted off the cap and took several swallows. Shit. He'd never cared one way or the other for the bitch. But something about her being dead made him uneasy. There was blood and death in the air already. And while that ordinarily made him feel right at home, he had a gut feeling that he was really going to be putting it on the line to make this hit. That was too bad, though. The money from the Shadow Fists was almost gone, and he needed another big score. This had dropped into his lap, and he wasn't going to blow it. Several more slugs of whiskey, and Koppel's familiar monotone relaxed him. He drifted off to sleep, wondering what the weather was like in Atlanta.
Tachyon hunched at the bar, ankles wrapped about the rungs of the high chrome stool. The light reflecting off the hanging wine glasses hurt his aching head, but he couldn't find the energy to look away. Mirrors. The mirrors of the funhouse, shattering as the kidnappers had come for Angel Face. A skull face reflected in 100 different angles as he entered Chrysalis's boudoir on the upper floor of the Crystal Palace. The invisible lips painted a pale pink, the swirl of glitter across one transparent cheek, the blue eyes floating eerily in their bony sockets. He had drunk in both those bars for more years than he cared to remember. Now the funhouse was closed following Dez's death a year ago. What would become of the palace? Drunken self-pity brought tears to Tachyon's eyes, and he considered his bereft state.
"Hey, buddy," asked the cheerful young bartender. "Another one?"
"Sure, why not?"
The bartender set up another brandy, and Tack raised it high.
"To the lost and mournful dead."
Tack drained the glass, scrawled his room number across the bottom of the bar bill, slipped off the stool. There was still a lot of activity in the lobby, even at this hour, but he spotted no one he knew. Tachyon considered calling Jack, but he wanted to drink and talk about Chrysalis, and the Big Ace hadn't known her. His aimless wanderings led him to the floor housing Barnett's party. Behind the doors, he could hear the low murmur of voices. He stared hard at one door, willing Fleur to emerge. It didn't work. His silent scrutiny of the suite drew the attention of a Secret Service guard. Tack saw him coming and stumbled back to the elevators. Back in his own room, he stared down at Blaze's tousled head. Sobs shook him as he knelt by the bed and enfolded the sleeping boy in his arms.
"Everyone always leaves me. Everyone I love leaves me. I love you so very much. Don't ever leave me."
Chapter 2, Tuesday, July 19th, 1988. 8 a.m. He'd been so drunk and upset last night that he hadn't noticed the message light on the telephone. Having now arrived at a state where his eyes focused and his head felt less like an enemy growth mounted on his shoulders, Tachyon sipped Alka-Seltzer and listened to the distant ringing.
"Lythe Van Rensselaer Memorial Clinic."
"This is Tachyon. Get me Finn."
"Hi, Doc. You must have heard by now."
"Yes."
"Things are in an uproar here. There was a firebombing at Barnett's Mission last night, and what I can only describe is free-form demonstrations in Chatham Square. I tried to reach you all afternoon."
"I didn't get back to the room till very late."
"I assisted on the autopsy. You want details?"
Tachyon sighed. "I suppose I must."
Finn ran down the findings. In the background, Tack could hear a sharp four-beat tapping as the pony-sized centaur danced on nervous, dainty hoofs. The Joker physician concluded with a wry,
"It'll sure as hell be a closed casket service."
"Damn, the funeral. When is it?"
"Tomorrow morning at 11.
"I will, of course, be there."
"How are things down in your neck of the woods?"
"Confusing. I don't even know the current delegate count."
He checked his watch. "Look, I've got to go. I'll see you tomorrow." Snatching up a hat, Tachyon paused at the bathroom door and yelled over the thunder of running water.
I'm off to breakfast with Jack. Meet me at 10:30, and we'll go over to the Omni. And be there.
There was no answer. Blaze was either plotting or sulking. Neither was an encouraging prospect.
Ms. Morgenstern.
Braden Dulles was younger than she was, but he had this state voice he put on, an authoritative Ben Bradley rumble like driving over a gravel road on a New England winter day, complete with frost crackling and the occasional squeak.
You have put this newspaper in a very difficult position.
She shifted in her bed, pulling a wad of pillow closer to her breasts. She had on a heavy blue flannel nightgown. It was how she always did hotels. In winter, leave the heat down. In summer, crank up the air conditioning and bundle up. She liked the insulation a lot of bedding gave her. She worked her eyelids ponderously up and down. She was normally a morning person. But last night, after Tachyon had brushed her off, the bastard, she'd been completely out of resources, had no idea what to do but take her chances returning to her room, where she slept the sleep of the clinically depressed. She turned an eye toward the clock radio on the nightstand. 8 a.m. If Dulles's call hadn't roused her, she might have gone on until afternoon. When she didn't respond, Braden went on.
It has been of concern to us here that you have of late been conducting what appears to be a personal vendetta against a major candidate for the presidential nomination.
Bitterness popped like a blister. Your fair-haired boy, you mean?
The Post has a tradition of awareness of its responsibilities as the newspaper of record in the nation's capital. Senator Hartman is obviously the best qualified candidate at this point in time.
You think this point in time's a good one to put a psychopathic ace in the White House? Christ! All Ronnie Reagan's done is invade some new country where we didn't belong every 2 years. This man, this creature, feeds on human misery, Braden. Anguished silence. She could just see the expression on his young patrician face, the constriction around the nostrils, the deepening of the network of grooves beyond his age that surrounded his mouth and radiated from the corners of his eyes, which he cultivated because they lent him gravitas, as if he'd just detected an aroma of dog turd within the sterile, hallowed sanctum of the Post.
We feel your obsession does credit neither to you as a journalist nor to us as a paper. Your latest report, if I may call it that, was simply incredible. Even were we inclined to accept such a farrago of wild accusation and innuendo, our legal department would never let us print it. And this attempt by Leo Barnett to smear Senator Hartman. Really, Sarah, how could you have lent your name to such a, well, frankly sleazy undertaking?
Barnett's people didn't ask me, Braden. I didn't know anything about it. I swear to God. She clung to the receiver as if it was the only thing holding her up. It was cool talisman hardness on her cheek.
You told me the allegations were true. Yet within hours, Senator Hartman had issued a denial, which we feel to have been quite convincing.
Because you wanted it to be. She tried to envision the Post accepting such an offhand denial of dubious dealing from a politician they didn't shine their golden light upon. A Nixon? A Robertson? Even a Bush? They'd hunt him to the end of the earth. But she could not speak. She had a good reporter's patter when she needed to draw people out. Somehow, though, the spoken word always managed to betray her when she tried to express something that really mattered to her.
Finally, Ms. Morgenstern, we are very concerned that you have evinced no intention of returning to New York. You are the acknowledged journalistic authority on Jokertown. We find it most unsettling that you refuse to take an interest in the murder, which involved the use of ace powers, I might add, of one of that community's most prominent citizens. One, I was given to understand, was a personal friend of yours. It would seem your story lay there.
The story's here, Braden. This is bigger than a killing in Jokertown. This concerns everybody. You, me, aces, jokers, people in Uganda, the whole world.
The president has so much power, so many... She stopped herself before she stumbled and fell headlong. That was a reason she'd always preferred the written word. The ones you spoke tended to get away from you. She drew a breath. Besides, Brayden, he's here. Chrysalis's murderer is here. Didn't you read my article?
Are you suggesting Senator Hartman personally beat Ms. Jory to death?
No. Damn you, Brayden, don't be so obtuse. He had it done. He used his ace. He used his position. What the hell difference does it make? He's still guilty, just like a mafia don who orders a hit. Dulles sighed.
I truly regret that it has come to this. Your personality disintegration has seriously degraded your professionalism. We therefore feel it is in neither your best interests nor ours for your association with this newspaper to continue.
You're firing me? Her voice rose toward the ceiling. Say it, Brayden. Just have the balls to say it.
I've said everything that needs to be said, Ms. Morgenstern. I will add my personal hope that you will soon seek therapy. You have too much ability to throw it away over addiction.
Addiction? She could barely produce the word.
Addiction to fear. Addiction to excitement. To the thrill of being a central figure in a vast and shadowy and menacing mystery. Addiction is the disease of the 80s, Sarah. Goodbye.
She heard a click and the white noise line. In her mind, she could see Brayden Dulles's hands, already scrubbed to a pink-white luster, washing each other in air. She threw the phone across the room and rose from the bed to dress. She felt like a cracked porcelain doll. As if any movement, any random breath of air, might splinter her all over the carpet.
9 a.m. Tack noticed with a flare of almost guilty pleasure that even among the greats of the nation, he was still newsworthy. The discreet hints that he and Jack had dropped yesterday had borne fruit. Reporters milled and jostled, ran microphone tests, camera checks. Jack had done a nice job of stage managing the entire affair, selecting a table flush against the low divider, separating the atrium coffee shop from the walkway. A tech snapped on a floor light, bleaching the big blonde ace. Jack squinted and shaded his eyes.
Bad night? Inquired Tack, sliding onto a seat opposite Jack. He kept his voice very low to avoid the foam phalluses that were already thrusting in their direction.
Late night. We had that challenge to Rule 9C governing the apportioning of delegates formally committed.
Jack, spare me the tedious details. Did we win or not?
Yes, thanks to me, which sets us up to win the California challenge.
Jack took a sip of coffee and lit a cigarette.
Do you have any idea how we're going to play this scene?
No.
Great, came the sour reply.
The edges of Tachyon's mouth quirked. I suppose I could just come around the table and give you a great big kiss. I'd kill you.
Tack shaded his eyes with a hand and scanned the crowd, noting the presence of Brokaw and Donaldson. Peregrine, who always knew how to time an entrance, came flying down from the 10th floor. The beating of her great wings fluttered menus and ruined blow-dried hairdos. Cameras swiveled up to document her landing. Tachyon reached out to her with his telepathy.
Good morning, sweet one. Ready to shill for us?
All ready, Tacky dearest. Mr. Braun, Doctor, aren't you rather unusual breakfast companions? Sang out Perry.
In what way? Asked Tack blandly.
Sam Donaldson picked up the ball, rapping out his question in his sharp, staccato manner. Your antipathy for one another is well documented. In a 1972 interview with Time magazine, Doctor, you said that Jack Braun was the greatest betrayer in American history.
Jack stiffened and ground out his camel. Tachyon felt a momentary regret at what he was going to be put through. Mr. Donaldson, you might note that that interview is 16 years old. People change. They learn to forgive.
So you've forgiven Mr. Braun for 1950?
Yes.
And you, Mr. Braun?
Sung out Buckley of the New York Times.
I have nothing to forgive. What I have are regrets.
What happened in the 1950s was a travesty. I see it happening again, and I'm here to sound the warning. Dr. Takian and I share more than just a past. We were drawn together because of our admiration for Greg Hartman. Then the senator arranged for your reconciliation?
Only by example, said Tak. He was one of the driving forces behind last year's World Health Organization tour to investigate the treatment of wild cards worldwide. The senator spoke movingly of reconciliation and the healing of old wounds. Tak glanced at Jack. I think perhaps both of us took that lesson to heart.
We also have another bond, said Jack. I'm a wild card, one of the first. Takian spent 42 years working among the victims of that virus.
It was a pleasant overstatement, but Tak didn't correct him. It would have brought up the fact that for 13 years, from 1950 to 1963, Takian had been a useless, alcoholic derelict roaming the streets and gutters of Europe and Jokertown, and the reason for his disintegration and deportation had been those fateful hearings before HUAC and Jack's betrayal.
And we don't like what's been happening in this country. The hate is back, and we fear it.
Takian fought free of the memories.
Then you accuse the Reverend Barnett of fanning the flames of hatred and intolerance?
Asked a serious-faced young man from CBS.
I believe Leo Barnett is acting from principle, as he sees it. But so was Anur al-Allah in Syria. And in that sad country, I saw innocent jokers stoned to death in the streets. Is that anguish something that we wish to see translated to our country?
Tak shook his head.
I think not. Greg Hartman
is a secret ace and a killer,
came a thin, tight voice from the crowd.
People drew back, repelled by the madness in Sarah's narrow face. Takian came half out of his chair.
Shit, muttered Jack.
What are you going to do, Dr. Takian? He's one of yours, one of the devil's stepchildren, and only you can stop him.
Tears blurred Sarah's words.
Do something, mind control her, something, whispered Jack.
And make a bad situation worse, he shot back in a bitter telepathic message to the ace. The crowd of reporters had turned on the woman like a pack scenting blood. She blanched and shrank back.
Miss Morgenstern, on what do you evidence does the Post?
The clamoring voices rose in intensity. To Takian's overstretched nerves, the sound seemed to take on a physical manifestation, a wave about to break over that fragile form. Sarah whirled and vanished into the crowd of interested onlookers. Takian stared at the eager, hungry faces of the press and bowed his head. They had to be fed. Mothers of my mother, forgive me, he prayed, and threw Sarah to the wolves.
That unfortunate girl does not deal well with stress, he called in a clear, penetrating voice. Yesterday's revelations concerning her and Senator Hartman.
Then there was an affair? Snapped Donaldson.
No. The child was in love with the senator and could not accept his continued refusal. I think she is torn between love for him and a desire for revenge. Remember, hell has no fury.
His voice trailed away.
Yeah, put in Jack. I tried to interest the young lady in my charms during the tour, but she was obsessed with the senator.
Sad, concluded Takian, but not as sad as what I've just done to her.
Who the hell are you? Sarah demanded shrilly. The man who had hold of her arm ignored her. Or maybe the tumult of questions and rage breaking over them like a tsunami drowned out her words. Something in his manner said he was ignoring her. The discreet security goons had come out of it first, of course, advancing in their dark three pieces, muttering into throat mics as they converged on her. She was standing there, erect and alone, challenging in her tea-green skirt and long-sleeved white blouse, chin elevated above a ruff considerably more modest than Tachyon's. She let the noise roll off her. She had spilled the truth out on the carpet like a turd shining and stinking in the hot TV lights, where it could not be overlooked or covered up. Now, she would accept the consequences. A hand caught her wrist, She turned, ready to aim a kick for a gabardine crotch. Instead of a husky young jock, it was a small, gray, balding man with a round belly hanging in a Mickey Mouse t-shirt. The watchdogs weren't even close. Now the gray man was towing her out a side door with the modest but irresistible authority of an East River tug. The security toughs got caught up in the back eddies of delegates and reporters shouting questions at each other. Her last view of the function room was Jack Braun staring after her, with his face rumpled up into a look of Sonny Tufts' bemusement, Tachyon beside him gazing about with neurasthenic dismay, like an underfed Regency buck whose man's man just farted in the wardrobe. Her rescuer, or whatever the hell he was, dragged her down a corridor past incurious idlers into a side service passageway. He used the momentum he'd imported to spin her around, back to a wall. A pack of reporters charged by, down the corridor, baying on the wrong trail.
"Is not the way to go about it," he said.
He had the kind of gruff, avuncular face only TV character actors have. His accent was Russian? Sarah lost it. This was simply too strange. She yanked her hand away, panicked more by the fact of contact than any ramification. He pressed in on her.
"No, you must listen. You are in very great danger."
"You're telling me, Buster." She squirmed past him and raced away, throwing a high heel in the process, toppling into the wall, scraping along, supporting herself with her hands while she kicked frantically to free herself of the other.
"Little fool," the man yelled after her. "The truth you have can kill."
The shoe finally came away, cartwheeling into the far wall. She ran.
10 a.m. Greg didn't remember sleeping at all during the night. At 6, Amy called to give him the early morning schedule and remind him of a 7 o'clock breakfast meeting with Andrew Young at Pompano's. By 7:45, he was in conference with Tachyon, Braun, and other key lobbyists and delegates about the Joker's rights plank and the party platform. At 8:10, it was minor difficulties with the Ohio delegation, which seemed to consider Greg a favorite son candidate since he'd been born in their state, and felt they deserved privileged access to him. 8:30 was a discussion with Ted Kennedy and Jimmy Carter concerning tomorrow's nomination speeches. Amy and John Worthen huddled with him to confirm the rest of the morning's schedule. Then Greg spoke briefly with Tony Calderone about the progress of his acceptance speech. Around 9:30, Tachyon came storming up, complaining that Sarah Morgenstern had finally gone too far. He informed Greg of her outburst downstairs.
"She is entirely insane," the alien raged. "Paranoid, delusions of persecution. We have to do something about her."
Greg agreed with that more than Tachyon could know. She'd become unpredictable and dangerous, and he didn't dare use Puppet Man to neutralize her. There was too much danger of Gimli's interference. With the problems he'd had with Puppet Man in the last few weeks, he couldn't afford the chance. A public scene would ruin everything. A little after 10, he was finally able to retreat to his room for a few minutes. Ellen was away, handshaking with delegates and campaigning outside. The rooms were blessedly deserted. A headache was pounding against his temples, and it had Gimli's voice.
"Why worry about Morgenstern? Sure, she's a fucking loose cannon, but she's not the problem I am, is she? You could handle her if you dared let Puppet Man out. Can you feel him yet, Greggy? Can you hear him howling for his fix? I can. You will, too, any time now."
"Shut up, damn you!"
He didn't realize he'd spoken aloud until he heard the faint echo of his voice. Gimli laughed.
"Sure, I'll be quiet for a little while. After all, I've already got you talking to yourself. Just remember that I'm still here, still waiting. But then I doubt you'll forget that, will you? You can't."
The voice went away, leaving Greg moaning and holding his head. "One problem at a time," he told himself. "Sarah first." He composed himself, reaching for the phone and dialing. There was the slight hiss of a long-distance connection, and then the phone at the other end rang.
"Hardman in 88,
a voice said with a strong Harlem accent.
"New York office, Matt Wilhelm speaking.
Furs, how are things up north? There was a laugh from the other end of the line. Wilhelm, also known in Jokertown as Furs, preferred his Joker name, as Greg knew. Senator, it's good to hear from you. I should have known it was you coming in on this line. Everything's going smoothly, if a little slow. We're waiting for the official announcement that you're our nominee. Then we'll move into overdrive. How's Atlanta? Hot and steamy and awfully warm down on the floor, from what I understand. Lots of resistance to the plank, Furs said. Greg could imagine the Joker's leonine features set in a scowl. I expected as much. I'm afraid so, but we're going to keep hammering away at it. You do that, Senator. In the meantime, what can Furs do for you? I'd like you to make a few phone calls. I could do it myself, but I have a meeting in a few minutes, and Amy and John are tied up with this platform business. You or someone on your staff got the time to give me a hand? Absolutely. Go ahead. Good. First check with Cuomo's office. Be sure to relay thanks for his help yesterday with file and shroud, and find out exactly when he's expected to arrive in Atlanta tomorrow. I want to know what arrangements have been made, and be sure one of our people picks him up at the airport. Then call our headquarters in Albany and have someone there confirm my reservation for the first week in August. Amy says she's never heard back from him. I also need you to call and make certain the New York apartment's ready for Ellen on Monday time. Into Tomlin, by the way, but John will be calling you with those details. Got it, Senator. Anything else? Greg closed his eyes, sinking back into the padded embrace of the couch. One more thing. There's another call. He recited the number he'd memorized before leaving New York. You won't get anything but an answering machine there, he told Furs. Don't worry about it. All you need to do is leave a short message on the machine. Just say to book a flight to Atlanta soonest. They'll know what that means. Book a flight ASAP, no problem. That all? That's all. Thanks, Furs. I'll be seeing you soon. Just get us Jokers a platform we can stand on. We'll do our damnedest. Take care. Give my regards to your staff. We couldn't do anything without their help. Greg placed the receiver carefully in its cradle. It was done. Mackie would be coming. Greg hadn't wanted the volatile ace in Atlanta, but he had to do something. Mackie should have disposed of Downs already. Now he could take care of Sarah. Very faintly, a sardonic voice answered him from beneath.
But what about me? What about me?
A KGB man hanging out at the Democratic convention? Ricky Barnes shook his long, trim head. Everybody already thinks you're in cahoots with Barnett, but maybe you should think about going to work for Robertson. Sounds like something his people would come up with, along with raising the dead and knowing where the hostages from Flight 737 were being kept in Calcutta.
That isn't funny, Ricky. She sat on the edge of his tautly made bed, methodically tearing a Kleenex into shreds. She spoke without heat. Ricky was maybe the first person she'd met in her life who could tease her without causing real pain.
Well, I mean, first you pitch your little scene in the midst of the Tack and Jack love feast. Then you say you're hauled out of the pot you set boiling by some old dude in a Mickey Mouse shirt. Who ever heard of a KGB man in a Mickey Mouse shirt?
What do KGB men wear, Ricky?
Rumpled suits and phony Rolexes. I've met KGB men, Sarah. So have you.
She tossed the ruined Kleenex on the floor. Well, who was he then?
Somebody with a hell of a lot more sense than you were showing, sweetheart.
She pulled her legs up on the bed, crossed them, put her head in her hands. Ricky watched her from the table, where he had his antique Epson Geneva laptop set up. He was wearing a dark brown pinstripe vest and trousers with a pale pink shirt and brown bow tie. With his elongated face and big, horsey white teeth, he reminded her of poor Ronnie, Greg's aide, who always disapproved of his boss's liaison with Sarah. The Red Army fraction had executed him when they kidnapped Hartman in Berlin. She blamed Hartman for his death. But it was only in appearance that he resembled Hartman's hapless aide. Ricky approved of her. He always did. Sometimes, she suspected, a bit too much.
Do you think I'm crazy? She asked.
Hell yes. Think about what if you're right, Rosie.
Rosie was his pet name for her. He claimed she looked like an albino Rosanna Arquette.
Standing right up there in front of God and everybody and announcing that Senator Gregg's a killer ace? Can you think of a quicker way to bring him down on your case if he is?
I mean it about Hartman. Everybody treats me as if I'm a leper because I don't think Gregg's the reincarnation of Abraham Lincoln or something. Ricky bit his lip and rubbed his chin with his fingertips. He was a pretty fair pianist in his spare time, and he had the hands for it, long and thin and fine.
I have to say, it strikes me as kind of improbable. All this ace mind control and stuff, how could he have kept it a secret all these years?
She started to cloud up. He held one hand protectively between them, fingers outspread.
But wait, wait now. You're a damn fine reporter, a damn fine person. I think your stories have maybe done more to promote understanding of jokers and their problems than Senator Gregg's posturing and his well-publicized handouts. Brother Malcolm knew all about what it means when the man extends a helping hand. I know you're not just making this up. But still, I know you still feel the loss of your sister very deeply. Is there any possibility that might be affecting your judgment?
She let her face drop between her hands, seeming to hold her head up by her almost white hair. When I was a child, she said, whenever I did something cute or clever, I could tell my parents were thinking, if only it were Andy. Do you know what I mean? When I was bad or clumsy, it was, Andy wouldn't do that. I mean, they'd never say anything that horrible, not out loud. But I knew. It was as if I had a wild card of my own, a poison psychic gift that let me know what they really thought. She was crying then, the tears rushing out as if someone had punched a big awl through her eyes and hit a giant reservoir of grief. Ricky was beside her on the bed, cradling her against his racquetball-trimmed chest, stroking her hair with those splendid fingers, while the mascara eroded from her face and stained his Brooks Brothers shirt in big, ugly blotches.
Sarah, Rosie, it's all right now, baby. It's all right. We'll get it straightened out. Everything will be okay. You're fine, sweetheart. Everything's going to be fine.
She clung to him like a baby opossum, welcoming human contact for one rare moment, letting him murmur his soothing words. Letting him hold her. I just hope he doesn't press too far, she thought.
The passengers walking the LaGuardia concourse gave plenty of sea room to the thin young man in the faded black jacket. It wasn't just the stale smell of sweat emanating from his seldom washed clothes and body. Mackie was so full of excitement at getting the call that he wasn't able to keep it all in. Parts of him kept going off into buzz. The subliminals were unnerving people. He looked up at the TV monitors next to the eastern gate. The gray alphanumerics confirmed once again that his flight was departing on time. He could actually see it there through the polarized glass. Fat and white, and glistening like snot in the July morning sun. The paper jacket that held his ticket and boarding pass was beginning to wilt in his hand. He didn't want to let go of it, even to slip it into a pocket. Chrysalis was dead. Digger vanished. But he got to kill one who was even better. The woman. The man had told Mackie about her. She had done it with the man on the tour. They broke up and she got crazy and might try to do something to the man. His man. He'd wanted to go out and find her as soon as he heard that. Put a good buzz on and cut her and watch the blood well up. But the man said no. Wait for my word, It had come a half hour ago, in the form of a coded call to the Bowery message drop. He was glad there was no smoking on airplanes. He hated smokers. Smoke us, choke us. He'd been on an airplane once, when he'd come across from Germany to be close to the man. He held his pass up to his face, opened it, shuffled through it. He could barely read the red type, and not just because it was blurred. He hadn't gotten what you called a good education in Germany. He never learned to read real well, even though he did learn to speak English. From his mother, the whore. The ticket had been waiting for him when he asked at the Eastern counter. The clerk there was afraid of him. He could tell. She was a fat nigger bitch. She thought he was a joker. You could see it in those calf-stupid eyes. People always thought he was a joker, especially women. That was probably why the man sounded funny. That woman after him. Women did that. Women were shit. He thought of his mother. The fat, cognac-swilling whore. The bottleneck stuck in her mouth in his mind, turned to a fat, nigger cock. He watched it slide in and out for a while, moistened his lips. His mother had fucked niggers. She'd fucked anybody with the ready in Hamburg's St. Pauli district, Riepe Bahnstraße, where he'd grown up. One of them had knocked her up. When she got drunk and beat Mackie up, she told him his father was a deserter, a GI, Stockholm-bound from Nam. But his father was a general. He knew. Mackie Messer was maximum bad. His father couldn't have been just anybody. Could he? His mother had abandoned him. Natürlich. Women did that. Made you love them so they could hurt you. They wanted you to put that man thing in them so they could take it away. Bite it off! He tried to imagine his mother biting off the huge black dick, but it dissolved into tears that streamed down his face and dripped off his chin onto the collar of his Talking Heads t-shirt. His mother had died. He cried for her again. Eastern Airlines Flight 377 for Raleigh, Durham, and Atlanta will now begin boarding passengers holding passes for rows 1 through 15. The ceiling said to him. He wiped away tears and blew his nose on his fingers and joined the big flow. He was going where he was wanted and was content.
Spectre stood in the jet's cramped restroom and splashed some water from the sink over his face. His stomach was churning and his skin was cold. He'd gone into the bathroom, hoping to throw up, but no luck. He was so nervous he couldn't even manage to take a leak. There was an impatient knock at the door. "I'll be out in a minute," Spectre said, drying the water from his face with his coat sleeve. Another knock. Harder this time. Spectre sighed and opened the door. A hunchback joker in a Talking Heads t-shirt was standing outside. He pushed past Spectre and closed the door. The little creep's eyes were like something dead, even worse than Spectre's. "Fuck you too, shrimp." Spectre clutched his way back to his seat without waiting for a reply. It was the first time he'd ever flown. The plane was much smaller than he'd expected and was getting bounced around by what the captain called some minor turbulence. He'd already put away two little bottles of whiskey and asked the stewardess to bring a couple more. She hadn't gotten back to him, though. He was sitting between a guy who had been a helicopter pilot in Vietnam and some reporter. The reporter was playing around with a laptop computer, but the ex-pilot hadn't stopped chattering since they boarded. "You see that redhead over there? Spectre followed the line of his finger to a woman a few rows away who was looking over at them. Her lipstick and tight-knit dress were bright crimson. Her eyes were green and heavily made up. She was licking her lips in an exaggerated manner. She wants me. I can tell. Wants me bad. Ever make it in a plane before? No. Spectre was clacking the two empty bottles together in his sweaty palm. The ex-pilot leaned back, brushed a piece of lint from his lapel, and sucked in his gut. Gotta play it cool, though. He looked out the window and nudged Spectre. You see those black dots out in the wing? That's where the rivets have been working back and forth. God, I hate flying in these death traps. I saw one miss the runway at National in Washington once. Nobody walked away from that one. If the impact doesn't get you, the fire and poison gas will. I was safer back in Nam. Spectre slipped the bottles into his suit pocket and turned to look for his stewardess. She was nowhere in sight. Probably in first class sucking off some rich shithead. He'd been an idiot to fly coach, but was a prisoner of his middle-class upbringing. Time to make the big move, the ex-pilot said. He made eye contact with the redhead and walked slowly to the rear of the plane. She smiled back at him and nodded, then started giggling when he disappeared into the restroom. Don't let him fool you, said the reporter without looking up. He was in his early 30s, about Spectre's size and already balding. These babies are safe as they can be. Really? Spectre said, trying to sound as nonchalant as possible. Yeah, he could tell you're a white knuckler. Just having some fun with you, I expect. The reporter folded up his computer and looked over at the redhead. Hope he has fun jerking himself off. The stewardess, a blonde with cropped hair who seemed slightly too large for her uniform, handed Spectre a plastic cup of ice and two more miniature Jack Blacks. Thanks, he said, fishing in his wallet for a small bill. He had one bottle opened and poured before she could make change. You going to Atlanta for the convention? The reporter asked. No. Spectre took a long, cool swallow. Not really into politics myself. Got other business. Not into politics? The reporter shook his head. This could be the most exciting convention since New York in 76. It'll be a real dogfight. Me? I'm betting on Hartman. The reporter sounded like someone who'd gotten a tip at the racetrack. Funny things can happen, especially in politics. Spectre drained the glass and opened the other bottle. A warm, empty feeling spread comfortably through his insides. If I were you, I wouldn't bet the farm. The ex-pilot stalked slowly up the aisle, his hands thrust deep into his pockets. He glared at the redhead. The plane lurched, and he bumped into the hunchbacked man. The Joker's hands seemed to blur for a moment, and Spectre thought he saw bits of dust spray up from the armrest. He hoped it was just the Jack Black kicking in. No such thing as a sure thing, Spectre said.
11 a.m. Five television sets were blaring in the living room of the suite the Hartman contingent had taken as staff headquarters, all tuned to different stations. On the screen nearest Greg, Dan Rather was holding forth with a patriarchal Walter Cronkite, back on the air for special convention coverage. Cronkite, as always, sounded the way you'd expect God would sound.
Perception is that despite the majority recommendation, Hartman simply isn't strong enough to guarantee passage of the Joker's rights plank. Does this indicate that Hartman isn't strong enough to win once the delegates are released from their first vote obligations? That Barnett, Dukakis, Jackson, or a dark horse like Cuomo may eventually emerge as the nominee?
Walter, no one has a lock on this convention. The closeness of the primary results show that.
Hartman is seen as a northern liberal who can't win in the South, and frankly, his long involvement with Joker causes is a liability outside the coasts and metropolitan areas. Barnett has southern appeal and could woo voters from Bush, especially among the fundamentalist factions. Still, he's too conservative and strongly religious for the Democratic constituency. Dukakis is Mr. Bland, with nothing particularly against him, but nothing particularly for him. Jackson has charisma, but the question remains whether he can win outside cities with large black populations. Gore, Simon, Cuomo, or any dark horse's only hope is a deadlock convention that turns to a compromise candidate. All this is reflected in the bitter platform fight. Of course, Greg twisted the knob, turning off the sound in mid-sentence. The other sets babbled on. Rather has his head up his ass, John Worthen commented. The right vice presidential candidate, and boom, there goes any regional weakness. Come on, they all know that, Tony Calderone threw in from across the room. They're just going for drama. Blame their writers. Greg nodded tiredly to no one in particular. Puppet Man was quiet. Gimli seemed to be gone for the moment, and Mackie would be on his way soon, if not already in flight. He felt drained, lethargic. The staff meeting had been going for an hour. Plastic cups of cold coffee sprawled everywhere, floating old cigarette butts, stacks of papers spilled from table to floor. Danishes were petrifying in cardboard boxes stacked on the floor. Greg's staff bustled through the blue-tinged air, a half-dozen conversations competing with the TV sets. Amy came through the hall door in a rush. Barnett's made it official, she announced as everyone turned to her. The minority report's not only against any Joker's rights plank, Barnett's personally calling for a return to the exotic laws. The room was loud with disbelief. With the surging emotions, Greg felt Puppet Man for the first time that day. That's crazy, Tony said. He can't be serious. Too damn stupid. It doesn't have a chance of being adopted, John agreed. Amy shrugged. It's done. You should see the convention floor. Goddamn chaos. Devon's going nuts trying to keep things calm with our delegates. Barnett's not worried about the floor. It's the outside convention he wants to influence, Greg told them.
Sir?
The Jokers, outside the Omni, in Piedmont Park. When they hear the news, they're going to explode. More fodder for his anti-Joker rhetoric. Puppet Man stirred below at the thought. Rising, Greg pushed him back. He'll lose the delegates on the fence. They'll think he's too militant, John again. Greg waved a hand. He's a one-issue candidate. The Jokers. He's obsessed. The man's not rational. That only gets said here. A quick laugh skittered around the room. Greg swung to his feet and tugged his tie into place, running fingers through gray-flecked hair. Okay, you folks know where to start, he said. If Barnett's going to start pushing, we have to push right back. Get on the phone, start using all the influence we have. What we need to do is get all the neutrals out of their corners. We're all agreed that Barnett's course will lead to greater violence out on the streets, to say nothing of the lack of compassion it shows. Tell him, pressure him, convince him. Get all our people doing the same. Amy, you might see if you can set up a meeting with Barnett for me. Maybe what he's really after is a compromise. In the meantime, I need to touch base with Ellen, see how she's doing. Then I'm going to see if I can do any good outside. The last words held a strange sense of anticipation. A feeling he hadn't expected. Greg began to wonder if Puppet Man was buried as deeply as he thought.
12 noon. Spectre followed the reporter into the men's room. The concourses were crammed with people, and he was sure that the man had noticed he was being tailed. Spectre didn't know the reporter's name. He preferred it that way, when he was going to kill someone. The reporter went to the far end of the busy bathroom and took the last stall. Spectre walked calmly over to the one that adjoined it and closed the door. He felt sort of bad about this, but the guy had shot off his mouth about how tight security was going to be at the hotel and how he'd greased a lot of palms to get his room there. These were things Spectre hadn't taken into account. He hadn't had time to make any plans. He usually played things by ear anyway. Spectre heard the pages of a magazine being turned in the next stall, but no sounds of progress.
He leaned down to make sure no one was close enough to see what he was up to. All the pairs of feet were facing toward the mirrors or moving toward the exit. He took a deep breath and slid off the toilet onto his back. He could feel the cold, damp tiles through his suit. Spectre grabbed the metal wall between the stalls and hauled himself under. The reporter folded up his magazine and looked down. He managed to blink a few times before Spectre locked in. His death experience rushed unchallenged into the reporter's mind. The man dropped the magazine and keeled over to one side. Saliva dribbling from the corner of his mouth, the man's pants were crumpled around his ankles. Spectre fished into the pockets and pulled out his wallet, then slid back into his own stall and up onto the toilet seat. He waited several moments for some sound indicating he'd been seen. There was only the incessant noise of shoes on tile and running water, punctuated by an occasional flush. Spectre flipped open the wallet. Everything he figured he'd need was there. Driver's license, a non-photo press card, social security card. The lack of ID would make it hard for the cops to identify the corpse. They'd probably figure that some opportunist lifted the wallet before calling them in. Things are going better than usual. He stood and flushed the toilet, then opened the door and walked to the mirror. He lifted his chin and turned his head side to side. Sharp and cool, he thought. He winked at the mirror and smiled crookedly. If everything worked out, he'd be on a plane back to Jersey tomorrow, and the Democrats would have one less hat in the ring.
It was as if New York's Jokertown had been turned upside down and dumped on the Atlanta streets. Every large city has its small version of a Jokertown, but Atlanta had never witnessed this kind of display. A blinding sun burned from cloudless blue onto a sea of signs, masks, and strangely distorted bodies. The crowd, estimated by the authorities at 15,000, had marched from Piedmont Park and besieged the Colosseum. Ranks of police and National Guardsmen watched, waiting. Mid-morning, when it was apparent that the majority report was not going to be quickly adopted, a bonfire had been started just down from the Omni. Before the encouraging cameras, shouting and chanting jokers burned their masks in the flames. A flying ace glider sailed from the crowd a little too close to the flames. The styrofoam melted, the wings turned brown, shrunken and deformed. A joker picked up the smoldering mess. "Hey, a fucking flying joker!" he shouted. The rest of the jokers picked up the bitter humor. Gliders all over the area sailed into the bonfire or were altered by holding them over Bic lighters. The Atlanta police unwisely chose that moment to clear the area. A double line of helmeted officers hit the ranks of demonstrators. The jokers predictably shoved back. Rocks were thrown. Someone's minor ace sent a few police sprawling. And suddenly, it was a full-fledged melee. Jokers, reporters, and bystanders were clubbed indiscriminately. The turtle appeared late in the fray and bellowed for order. His telekinetic power forcibly pushed apart the remaining jokers and police. Some 60 people were arrested, and though the injuries were largely minor, the shots of bloodied heads were spectacular. The mood of the demonstrators, already fragile, turned ugly. A few blocks from the convention site, the jokers reformed. Fire hydrants were opened by the jokers to abate the day's heat. Each time, the police moved in to shut them off again but avoided direct confrontations. Taunts were exchanged across the lines. A counter-demonstration by the KKK arrived downtown in the late morning, producing scattered skirmishes between Klansmen and jokers in the streets. If anything, the Klan was more brutal than the police. Shots were reported, and jokers were treated for gunshot wounds at the local hospitals. Wildfire rumors spread through the crowd that two jokers had died, that the police were not arresting KKK members, and had, in fact, let them through the barricades. At noon, word arrived that Leo Barnett was calling for a return to the exotic laws, Barnett was crucified in effigy in front of the Omni. The turtle's shell hovered overhead as if herding the demonstrators, keeping a clear space between jokers and police.
"I don't like it, Senator," Billy Ray told Greg as they stepped from the limo near the barricades. Other Secret Service men in three-piece suits flanked them. The Joker crowd bristled with shouts and curses. "I don't think this is a good idea."
Greg grimaced, irritated. He gestured harshly at the ace. "And I'm getting tired of people telling me what I should do." Ray's mouth tightened into a hard line with the rebuke. Before Ray could answer, a shadow fell over them, and a voice boomed from loudspeakers.
"Senator! Hey, you come out to help?"
The noise brought the cameras around. Greg waved up at the turtle's shell. The turtle had a squadron of turtle-shaped flying ace glider frisbees hovering around him like electrons around a nucleus. A few melted, fucking flying jokers were mixed in with the group.
"I was hoping we might keep things calm, at least. I know you're doing what you can." "Yeah, frisbee tricks, latest in crowd control."
The frisbees began whirling faster, looping in intricate patterns.
"Think you can get me into the crowd?"
"No problem."
Frisbees rained on the pavement. The shell dipped gracefully, banking behind the barricades and swiveling so that it faced into the crowd. The loudspeakers hissed as the volume was nudged higher.
"Okay, move the barricades aside. Make a path for the senator or I'll have to make it for him. Come on, people!"
Hovering at head height, the turtle eased through the barricades and into the jokers like a plow. Greg stepped forward in his wake. Carnifex, the Secret Service people, and several of the police followed. Reporters and cameramen jostled for position. Greg was recognized immediately. The chant began to rise on either side of the turtle and his entourage.
"Hartman! Hartman!"
Greg smiled, reaching out to brush the hands that stretched toward him from the front ranks.
"Hartman! Hartman!"
He was beaming, his jacket off and his tie loosened. A patch of sweat darkened his spine. The candidate at work. He knew the scene would be featured in all the evening reports. Inside, he was not so complacent. The crowd was charged with emotional energy. The current was nearly visible to him, pulsing and surging, and it drew Puppet Man like a lure. He could feel the power strengthening, rising, growing.
"Let me out," it told him. "Let me taste." "There's Gimli," he reminded Puppet Man. "Remember 76.
As if Greg had spoken an invocation, Gimli's faint voice echoed,
"I remember 76, Hartman. I remember it very well. And I also remember what happened yesterday with Ellen. Tell me, how did you like being a fucking puppet? Go on. Let your friend out. I might not stop you this time. Of course, if I did, he might get mad. Maybe Puppet Man would walk you around again. The news services would all love that."
Puppet Man snarled at Gimli, but Greg shivered behind his smile. Puppet Man shook the bars of his cage as the Joker's energy shimmered around them. Greg held the door shut with an effort.
"Hartman! Hartman!"
He smiled, he nodded, he touched. The temptation to let Puppet Man out and ride with him was maddening. In that, Gimli was right. Greg wanted it too. He wanted it as much as he wanted anything. The turtle came to a halt in the middle of International Boulevard near the effigy of Barnett.
"Get on, Senator," he said.
The shell swayed lower until it was only a foot above the pavement. Greg stepped up. Billy Ray and the others circled the turtle. An enormous shout went up as he climbed the shell. Sensitive despite his burying of Puppet Man, he was nearly staggered by the emotional impact of their massed adulation. Greg slipped and nearly fell. He felt the turtle lift him with an almost tender push.
"Geez, Senator, I'm sorry. I guess I wasn't thinking."
Greg stood on top of the shell. Joker faces peered at him, pressing against the turtle's telekinetic barrier. The sound of their cheering echoed from the Omni and the WCC, deafening. He shook his head, smiling in the modest, half-shy way that had become the Hartman trademark during the long campaign. Greg let the chant go on, feeling the insistent beat hammer at him. Puppet Man rode with it. Though Greg held him in, he could not keep the power from rising to the surface of his mind. He looked out at the Jokers and saw familiar faces among them. Peanut, Flicker, Fartface, Marigold, and the one called Grave Mold who had finally brought down Typhoid Croyd. Puppet Man saw them too, and the power slammed hard against the mind bars, growling and tearing. Greg trembled with the effort of controlling the ravenous personality and knew he could not stay out here long. His hold was crumbling under the assault of their emotions. Brilliant, undiluted primary colors swirling all about him, Puppet Man could almost touch them and see them sway like tinted smoke. Greg raised his hands for silence. "Please!" he shouted, and heard his amplified voice rebound from the buildings around them. "Listen to me! I understand your frustrations. I know 4 decades of ill treatment and misunderstanding are aching to be released, but this isn't the way. This isn't the time." It wasn't what they wanted to hear. He felt their distaste and hurried. "Inside that building, we're fighting for Joker's rights." Shouts of encouragement, aching green and knife-edged yellow. "What I'm asking is that you help me in that fight. You have a right to demonstrate. But I tell you that violence in the streets will be used as a tool against you. My opponents will point and they will say, 'You see, Jokers are dangerous. We can't trust them. We can't let them live anywhere near us.' Now's the time for all Jokers to finally cast off their masks, but you must show the world that the face underneath is the face of a friend." The shaded currents turning muddy brown with confusion and uncertainty. The brightness dimmed. "With me, you could do it easily," Puppet Man mocked him. "Look out there. Together, we could turn this around. We could end the demonstration. You'd walk away a hero. Just let me out." Greg was losing them. Even without Puppet Man's direct link, he knew that. Greg Hartman was suddenly saying the same words they'd heard all along from everyone else. There was no magic anymore. No Puppet Man. Shifting to a dark, somber violet, a dangerous hue, a feeding color. Puppet Man screamed. Greg had to leave. The emotions like a storm-tossed tide battering the shore eroded the tenuous hold on his power. Puppet Man would leap out. He had to end it, had to get away from the feast spread before his power. "I'm asking, begging you to help those who are down there on the floor. Please, don't let anger ruin it all." It was a horrible, abrupt ending. Greg knew it. The crowd stared at him, silent. A few tried to begin the chant again, but it died quickly. "Get me down," Greg whispered. The turtle lifted him slightly and lowered him to the concrete. "Let's get out of here," Greg said. "I've done all I can do." Puppet Man clawed at Greg in desperation, lashing out in his mind like a mad animal. The turtle backed slowly through the crowd toward the waiting limo. Greg followed, frowning. He saw and heard nothing of what was in front of him. It took all of his concentration simply to hold Puppet Man in.
1 p.m. He'd been in the cab for more than an hour. Traffic was snarled almost as soon as he left the airport. Cars were jammed bumper to bumper, horns blaring all the way into downtown. Pedestrians, mostly Jokers, were masked in the streets. Some wore masks, some carried signs. All were in a dangerously surly mood. More than once they had rocked the cab as it cruised slowly through them. Spectre had given the driver an extra C-note to get him within a block of the hotel. Judging by the grumbling from the front seat, the cabbie was having second thoughts in spite of the money. The driver's license had been easy. He'd doctored them before. After removing the lamination, he carefully razored out the reporter's photo and replaced it with one of his own. Then he'd used a laminating machine at the airport to finish the job. The reporter, his name had been Herbert Baird, was close to the same height, weight, and age as Spectre. Right now, though, getting caught with fake ID was the least of his worries. Spectre just wanted to get to the Marriott in one piece. A Joker with huge folds of wrinkled pink skin jumped onto the hood and waved a sign that said,
Gnats are rats, on one side, and what about us, on the other? There was chanting up ahead. Spectre couldn't make out what they were saying.
Fires will go, missus, said the cabbie. I ain't playing joker bet with $100 or $100,000. How far to the hotel?
Spectre had his luggage in the back seat with him. He figured it would be a mess downtown, and he didn't want to spend any more time than absolutely necessary picking through a crowd of pissed-off jokers.
About 2 blocks straight ahead.
The driver looked around nervously as one of the taillights was kicked in. I'd move if I were you. Right. Spectre opened the car door carefully and stepped out onto the crowded sidewalk. Some of the jokers made faces at him or raised their fists, but most didn't give him any trouble. He moved forward slowly, unhappily aware that his new suit and luggage would make him conspicuous and a likely target. After about 10 minutes of pushing and shoving, the hotel was just across the street. Spectre was covered in sweat and starting to smell like the freaks around him. A joker with needle-like fingernails stepped in front of him and took a swipe at his suitcase, shredding one side. Spectre caught his eye and fed him just enough death pain to make the joker collapse. He didn't want to risk stirring up this mob with a killing. Hot as it was, these bimbos wouldn't think twice about someone passing out. The crowd was beginning to break up, doubtless to reform somewhere else, as he stepped into the hotel lobby. It was open all the way to the roof. The building's curves reminded him of the inside of something dead. Spectre took a breath of cool air and walked over to the security area. Herbert Baird, you're Herbert Baird, Herbert Baird, he thought. There were several uniformed cops and suited men with earpieces waiting for him.
Identification, please, said one of the cops.
Spectre pulled out his wallet, trying consciously to relax, and handed over the driver's license. The cop took it and passed it over to a man sitting at a computer terminal. The man typed for an instant, his fingers blurring on the keys, then paused, and finally nodded.
Can I have your luggage, Mr. Baird?
The officer looked at the Comox on the side.
Bit rough out there, eh?
Plenty more than what I'm used to, Spectre smiled. They were bored and not paying much attention to him. He was going to get in. The officer set the suitcase onto the X-ray machine and pointed to a metal detector.
If you please walk through, sir.
As he stepped under, the metal detector's alarm beeped. Spectre stopped dead and reached slowly into his pocket. He could feel at least 20 people staring at him. He pulled out a fistful of change and handed it to the cop. He'd needed it for the laminating machine. Mind if I try again? The cop motioned him forward with a slow sweep of his hand. Spectre stepped through noiselessly and sighed. The officer reached round and handed him his change. Spectre pocketed it and smiled again.
Your bag's right there.
The cop pointed and then turned back to the hotel entrance. Spectre picked up his suitcase. He was heavy and almost slipped out of his sweaty palm. He walked slowly across the lobby to the registration desk. There weren't many suits that didn't have bulges under them. Getting his room took longer than it should have. The clerk was a fat, officious prick who gave him the fisheye when he said he'd be paying in cash. The little creep was trying to impress the Secret Service boys or something equally stupid. It was probably his once-in-a-lifetime chance to be a big cheese. Spectre would come back someday and drop the guy. He snatched the key when the clerk finally offered it and headed quickly for the elevators. He was almost there when he heard someone call out,
James! James Spectre! Hey, Specs!
The voice sounded familiar, but that wasn't necessarily good.
He turned around slowly. The man walked up to him, smiling, and held out a hand. He wore an ash-gray suit and had carefully styled hair. He was a couple inches shorter, Inspector, but much more muscular. Tony C. He let out a breath and relaxed his shoulders. No way this is happening. He and Calderoni had grown up together in Teaneck, but Spectre had lost track of him years ago. Tony reached down, grabbed Spectre's hand, and gave it a firm shake. My main man, the pick-and-roll prince. What are you doing here? Lobbying, Spectre coughed. What about you? I work for Hartman, Tony replied. Spectre opened his mouth, shut it quickly. Hard to believe, I know, but I'm his top speech consultant. He rubbed his palms together. I always did have a good line. Especially for the girls. Spectre shuffled uncomfortably. Apparently none of the cops who'd checked his ID card had heard Tony, but he still felt exposed. Look, it's great to see you, but I'd like to get settled in. It's a real zoo outside, I tell you. If you think it's a zoo out there, you should see what's going on inside. Tony slapped Spectre on the shoulder. There was real warmth in the gesture, the kind Spectre hadn't been exposed to in years. What's your room number? Spectre held up his key card. 1031. 1031, got it. I want to have dinner while you're down here. We got plenty to go over. Tony shrugged. I don't even know what you've been doing since high school. Fine. I got plenty of time to kill while I'm down here, Spectre said. The elevator pinged behind them. Tony backed away and waved. See you later. Spectre tried to sound like he didn't dread the idea. This was turning out to be weirder than Freakers on New Year's Eve.
Hiram was hosting a reception in his suite at the Marriott. Greg was supposed to put in an appearance, so the rooms were packed with New York delegates and their families. Most of the suites Tachyon had entered stank of cigarettes and old pizza. This one stank of cigarettes, but the trays dotted strategically through the rooms held tiny quiches and pierogi. Tack snagged one, and the flaky pastry exploded in his mouth, followed quickly by the rich flavor of its mushroom filling. Brushing crumbs from his fingertips and the lapels of his coat, Tack reached up and patted Hiram on the shoulder. The big ace was dressed with his usual flair, but circles hung like bloated bruises beneath his eyes, and his skin had the unhealthy look of moist dough.
Don't tell me you had time to slip down to the kitchens and cook all this, teased Tachyon.
No, but my recipes...
I suspected as much.
Tack bent and flicked a crumb from the top of his patent leather pump with the edge of his handkerchief. When he straightened, he had gathered his courage.
Hiram, are you all right?
The word exploded in a sharp puff.
Why?
You look unwell. Come to my room later, and I'll check you over.
No, thank you, but no, I'm fine, just tired.
A smile creased the broad face as if it had been abruptly painted on by a cartoon animator. Tachyon expelled a pent-up breath, shook his head as he watched Hiram bustle away to greet Senator Daniel Moynihan. The alien circulated, smiling, shaking hands. It still struck him as an odd custom, even after all these years. On Tachis, there were two extremes. Limited contact, because between telepaths, casual touching was repugnant, or between close friends and relatives, the full embrace. Either choice caused problems on Earth. The light touch seemed snobby, and the full embrace raised homophobic reactions in the males of this planet. So Tachyon mused and watched his gloved hand being swallowed again and again by the eager, clasping fingers of the humans who engulfed him. On a sofa set beneath one of the windows, a man sat surrounded by three laughing women. The youngest sat on his knee. Behind him, her sister leaned in and twined her arms about his neck. Next to him on the sofa was a pretty gray-haired woman. Her dark eyes were affectionate as they rested on his face. There was a warmth in the scene that seemed to touch the emptiness that Tachyon felt in his own life.
Come on, Daddy, pleaded the youngest. Just one little speech. Her voice altered slightly, gaining in sonority and depth. What is it that you would impart to me? If it be aught toward the general good, set honor in one eye and death in the other, and I will look on both indifferently. For let the gods so speed me as I love the name of honor more than I fear death.
No, no, no,
the man punctuated each word with a shake of the head. Julius Caesar might not be the best choice for a political convention, said Tachyon softly. Four sets of dark eyes regarded him. Then the man lowered his gaze and his fingers combed nervously through his gray-shot beard.
Pardon my intrusion, but I could not help overhearing. I am Tachyon.
We sort of guessed, said the girl behind the sofa. She surveyed the Tachyon's brilliant outfit of green and pink and tossed a droll look to her sister.
Josh Davidson.
The man indicated the woman beside him. My wife, Rebecca, and my daughters, Sheila and Edie.
Charmed.
Tachyon brushed his lips across the back of three hands. Edie chuckled, her gaze flickering between her father and sister. Emotion swirled about the little party. There was something just beneath the surface that Tachyon was missing, but deliberately missing. People had their secrets, and just because Tachyon could read them didn't mean that he had the right. Another lesson learned after 40 years on Earth was the necessity of filtering. The cacophony of untrained human minds would soon have driven him mad if he hadn't lived huddled behind his shields.
Now I recognize you, said Tachyon. You were brilliant last winter in Dull's house. Thank you. Are you a delegate?
Oh, God, no. The woman laughed. No, my daughter Sheila is our representation. Daddy's a bit of a cynic where politics are concerned, said the older sister. We were lucky to get him down here at all.
Keeping an eye on you, young lady.
He thinks I'm still 10, she confided with a wink to the Tachyon.
A prerogative of fathers.
Davidson was staring so intently up at him that Tachyon wondered if this particular father was also sending him a warning. Touch my daughters and lose your nuts. For his own amusement, Tack decided to push it. He turned his blazing smile on the lovely Davidson daughters.
Perhaps I might buy the ladies Davidson lunch tomorrow.
Sir, said Sheila severely, but her eyes were dancing. Your reputation precedes you. Tack laid a hand over his heart and faltered.
Oh. My fame. My lamentable fame. You love it,
said Davidson, and there was a funny faraway expression in his expressive eyes.
A condition that we perhaps share, Mr. Davidson. No, oh no, I think not.
There were polite murmurs all around, and Tack moved on. He felt eyes boring into the middle of his back, but didn't look back. It wouldn't do to encourage either of these lovely girls. He was only doomed to disappoint them.
5 p.m. Greg had taken most of the other candidates for puppets as a matter of course. It was easy enough. All Greg needed was to touch them for a few seconds. A lingering handshake was enough, long enough for Puppet Man to cross the bridge of the touch and crawl into the other person's mind. There to prowl in the caverns of hidden desires and emotions, bringing all the filth to life. Once the link was established, Greg no longer needed the physical contact. As long as the puppet was within a few hundred yards, Puppet Man could make the leap mentally. Greg artfully used Puppet Man during the campaign to make the other candidates stumble over a question or seem too forceful and blunt in stating their positions. He'd done that until Gimli had started interfering late in the primaries and Puppet Man became too erratic and dangerous to use. Even though he'd had the opportunity, he'd left Jesse Jackson alone. The Reverend was charismatic and forceful, a powerful speaker. Greg even admired the Reverend. Certainly no one else in the campaign was so unabashedly straightforward, so unafraid of making bold statements. Jackson was an idealist, not a pragmatist like the rest. That was one strike against him.
and Greg knew from experience that prejudice was also real, that it was easy for the average person to mouth sympathy, but not to act on it. The Joker prejudice was real. The black prejudice was real. With or without Puppet Man, Jackson would not become president even if he managed to get the nomination. Not this year. Not yet. It was something Greg dare not say in public, but he also knew that Jackson was well aware of the fact, no matter what the man might say. So Greg had let Jackson go his own way. In a way, it had made for a more interesting primary campaign. Now, with Puppet Man wailing inside and far too unreliable to let loose again, Greg was forced to admit that it might have been a mistake. It would have made things much easier now. The Reverend Jackson sat across the room from Greg in a voluminous leather armchair, his legs crossed over impeccably pressed black pants, his expensive silk tie knotted tightly around his throat. Around the Jackson campaign suite, his aides pretended not to watch. Two of Jackson's sons flanked the Reverend on wooden chairs. Barnett is making a mockery of the Joker's rights plank, Greg was saying. He's diluting the impact by dragging in every special interest group he can think of. The trouble is that alone, I can't stop him. Jackson pursed his lips, tapped them with a forefinger.
You come asking for my help now, Senator. But once the platform fight is over, it will be business as usual. As much as I disagree with the Reverend Barnett on basic issues, I understand the political reality. The Joker's rights plank is your child, Senator. Without that plank's passage, you'll hardly appear to be a very effective leader for the country. After all, it's your own fundamental issue, and you can't even make your own party listen.
Jackson looked almost pleased at the prospect.
I can take care of that. Just let me out. Puppet Man was angry, irritated, the power pushed at its restraints, wanting to lash out at the self-confident Jackson. Leave me alone, just for a few minutes. Let me get through this.
Greg shoved the power back down, leaning back in his seat to cover the momentary inner conflict. Jackson was watching him very carefully, very intently. The man had a predator's eyes, mesmerizing and dangerous. Greg could feel sweat starting on his brow, and he knew Jackson noticed it as well. I'm not concerned with the nomination at the moment, Greg said, ignoring Puppet Man. I'm concerned with helping the Jokers, who have experienced the same prejudice as your own people. Jackson nodded. An aide brought a tray over to the coffee table between them.
Iced tea? No?
Very well. Jackson took a sip from his own glass and set it down again. Greg could see the man thinking, gauging, wondering.
And with me, you could truly know. You could control those feelings.
Be quiet.
You need me, Greggy. You do.
Intent on keeping Puppet Man down, he missed the next few words.
Rumor is that you have been pushing your people very hard, Senator. You have even angered some of them. I've heard tales about instability, about a repeat of 76.
Greg flushed, started to retort heatedly, and then realized he was being goaded. This was exactly the reaction Jackson was trying to provoke. He forced himself to smile. We are all used to a certain amount of mudslinging, Reverend. And yes, I've been pushing hard. I always push when I believe in something strongly.
And the accusation makes you angry. Jackson smiled and waved a hand. Oh, I know the feeling, Senator. In fact, I had the very same reaction when people questioned my work for civil rights. I'd expect it.
He steepled his hands under his chin and leaned forward, elbows on knees.
Just what is it you want, Senator?
A Joker's rights plank. Nothing more.
And how do you propose to buy my support?
I had hoped you would agree purely for the sake of the Jokers. On humanitarian grounds.
Oh, I feel deeply for the Jokers. Believe me, Senator. But I also know that a plank and a platform is just so many words. A platform commits no one to anything. I will fight for the rights of all oppressed people, with or without planks. I did not promise my people planks. I promised them I would do my best to win at this convention, and I am doing just that. I do not need a plank. You do.
Jackson reached for the glass again. He sipped, waiting and watching. All right, Greg said at last. I've talked with Devon and Logan on this.
If you keep your delegates in line, we'll release our Alabama delegates after the first vote with the strong recommendation they go to you. Alabama isn't important to you. You took what, 10% of the delegates there? That 10% could be yours. You were second to Barnett in Alabama. More importantly, it might indicate that momentum in the South was moving away from Barnett, which would benefit you. And you as well, Jackson pointed out. He shrugged. I was also second in Mississippi. Son of a bitch. I'll have to confirm this, but I can probably release my delegates there as well. Jackson paused. He looked over at his sons, then back to Greg. I need to think about this, he said.
You're letting it slip away, dammit. He's only going to ask for more. I could have made him agree without any concessions. You're a fool, Greggy.
We don't have time, Greg said sharply. He regretted the words instantly. Jackson's eyes narrowed, and Greg hurried to smooth over the gaffe. I'm sorry, Reverend. It's just that to the jokers out there, the platform isn't words. The plank will be a symbol for them. A symbol that their voices have been heard. We all stand to gain, all of us who support them. Senator, you have a fine humanitarian record, but...
Let me have him.
Reverend, sometimes my passion gets out of hand. Again, I apologize. Jackson still frowned, but the anger was gone from his eyes.
You almost blew it. Shut up. It was your interference. Let me handle it. You have to let me out. Soon. Soon. I promise. Just be quiet.
All right, the Reverend was saying. I think I can arrange things with my people. Senator, you have my support. Jackson held out his hand. Greg could feel his fingers trembling as he took it.
Mine. Mine.
The power shuddered inside, screaming and clawing and throwing itself at the bars. It took all Greg's effort to hold Puppet Man back as he shook hands with Jackson, and he broke the contact quickly. Senator, are you all right? Greg smiled wanly at Jackson. I'm fine, he said. Thank you, Reverend. Just a little bit hungry, that's all.
6 p.m. Where I was raised, a person does not seat themselves uninvited at another person's table. Takian shuffled through the 7 pink message slips, all from Hiram, and thrust them into a pocket. Where you were raised, a person also does not fail to acknowledge and thank another person for a gift. I know I was there when you first learned to lisp out "tank u" when I would bring you candy. The fury flaming in Fleur's brown eyes was so intense that Takian flinched and half raised a hand in defense. Leave me alone! I cannot. Why? She wrung her hands, the fingers twisting desperately through one another. Why are you torturing me? Wasn't killing my mother enough? In all fairness, I think your father and I must share the blame. I broke her mind, but he allowed her to be tortured in that sanatorium. If he had left her with me, I might have found a way to repair the broken shards. If that was the choice, then I'm glad she died. Better that than being your whore. Your mother was never a whore. You dishonor her and yourself by that remark. You can't really feel that way. Well, I do. And why should I feel any differently? I never knew her. You saw to that. I didn't throw her out of the house. She could have gone to her parents. She loved me. I can't imagine why. Give me a chance. I could show you. As soon as the glib, flirtatious comment passed his lips, Takian knew he had done a very stupid thing. As if to hold back the words, he pressed his fingers to his lips. But it was too late. Far, far too late. 40 years too late. Fleur rose from her chair like a wrathful goddess and dealt him a ringing slap. Her nail caught on his lower lip, splitting it, and he tasted the sharp, coppery taste of blood. All conversation ceased in Pompano's. The silence made his skin crawl, and Tachyon chewed down the humiliation that filled his mouth like a foul taste, the dick of her high heels as she stormed from the restaurant, beat into his ringing head. Carefully, he held up two fingers before his face, counted them, dabbed at the cup with her discarded napkin. It smelled faintly of her perfume. His jaw tightened into a stubborn line.
8 p.m. Muscular dystrophy, is it up or down on MS, Charles? Christ, Devon's voice, roaring through Jack's cellular phone, seemed surlier than ever. I guess we can't be against Jerry's kids, can we? The convention band staggered into the last bars of MAME. Louis Armstrong could have played it better in his sleep. Jack was on the convention floor, standing on a scarred gray folding chair, surrounded by his throng of Californians. Up or down, Charles? Jack demanded. Up, shit, up! Jack could clearly hear Devon's fist banging on a desktop. Shit, 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 fuck, cunt! That bitch! That fucking wasp slut! I want to wring Fleur Van Rensselaer's neck. You'll have to stand in line behind me, buddy. They're calling the vote. Emil Rodriguez tugged on Jack's sleeve. Jack hung up his portable phone and gave the thumbs-up sign to his horde of delegates. He tried to picture thousands of Americans in wheelchairs and leg braces cheering and reshuffling their political alignment, but his imagination failed. Rodriguez, a short, bull-chested man, looked up at Jack with fury in his eyes. This sucks, man, he spat. Jack got down from the chair and lit up a smoke. You said it, essay. Jim Wright gabbled for order. Jack looked at the dissolving huddles of delegates and considered the chaos that had descended on Atlanta today. The violent demonstrations, the platform fight, Sarah Morgenstern's bizarre interruption of the press conference that morning. Secret ace, he thought. And then he thought, which one? For hours, the convention had been tearing itself to bits over the Joker's rights plank. The platform committee had passed it with a strong dissent from Barnett's crowd. Barnett had moved the issue onto the floor while no one was looking, and then the sweaty brawl started in earnest. Barnett's people stood united against the plank, Hartman for, and Jackson made a principled stand with Hartman. The others had just tried to delay things till they could work out how much mileage they could get out of declaring one way or another. The thing might have breezed through if it hadn't been for the violence surrounding the Joker camp that afternoon. The middle-of-the-road candidates hung on for as long as possible, wondering if there was going to be an anti-Joker backlash. But eventually the delegates began sidling toward the Hartman point of view. It was then that the Barnett campaign made their master stroke. Since they realized they couldn't stop the plank from passing, they began their attempts to dilute it. Why should the party be only in favor of Joker's rights, they asked. Shouldn't the party declare in favor of the rights of people with other handicaps? Soon there was an up or down vote on whether victims of multiple sclerosis should be included in the civil rights plank. While Hartman's managers, knowing perfectly well they were being sandbagged, cursed, and threw furniture, the motion passed unanimously. No Democrat was going to be caught dead opposing people with an incurable illness. Other diseases followed. Amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Guillain-Barré syndrome, spina bifida, post-polio syndrome. The vote on that one was close, mainly because no one had ever heard of it. And now Jerry's kids. Barnett was succeeding in making the whole Joker's rights issue look ridiculous. Barnett's delicate head from Texas, a blue-haired woman in a white cowboy hat, red lacquered boots, and a matching red skirt and vest with a swaying white buffalo bob fringe, was on her feet making another motion. Jack told his phone to dial HQ and climbed on his chair again. Jesus Christ, said Rodriguez. It's AIDS. A panicked yelp went up from the convention. Barnett had made his master stroke. The eyes of every viewer panicked by retrovirus homophobic hysteria would be glued to the set, ready to see if the Democrats would endorse the pollution of their bodily fluids by lurking sodomites and junkies drooling contamination from every orifice. Furthermore, Barnett had convincingly linked AIDS with xenovirus Tacus A. Up or down, Charles? Jack asked wearily. Fuck the queers, Devon raged. The hell with this! Jack grinned and gave his people the thumbs down. The retrovirus lost in a landslide. The convention had had enough of Barnett's tactics. The distractions had provided amusement for a while and had succeeded in their principal duty of making Hartman's convictions look silly, but now they were getting tiresome. The Texas lady received instructions from on high and called for no more votes. Hartman's people quietly moved that all other persons suffering from diseases were to be included in the civil rights plank. the motion passed unanimously. The platform was moved and passed. Jim Wright gaveled the long day to a weary end. Hats and signs and flying ace gliders soared into the air from thankful delegates. Jack told his delegates to be ready bright and early the next morning. By the end of Wednesday, there were going to be at least two ballots, and they would say a lot about where the convention was headed. He lit another Camel and watched the thousands of delegates funneling out the exits. The band serenaded their retreat with "Don't Cry for Me, Argentina." For once, Jack didn't react to the hated song. He was thinking about a secret ace.
9 p.m. Billy Ray called Greg from the Marriott's lobby. "Senator, you still interested in meeting with Barnett? Lady Black just told me he's on his way back to the hotel from a meeting." It had been a horrible day. The afternoon and evening were worse than the morning. Amy, John, and finally Devon had tried vainly to arrange a conference with Barnett. They'd gotten as far as Fleur, who told them flatly that Barnett wasn't interested in speaking with Greg. The struggle on the floor had reflected that uncooperative attitude. Either Barnett or Fleur Van Rensselaer had turned out to be a savvy political strategist. It had taken all of Greg's influence to keep any kind of Joker's rights plank in the platform at all, and without the support of Jackson, it would have been impossible. The plank finally adopted was a toothless, emasculated version of the original, fettered with conditions and clouded language. The kindest thing that could be said of it was that it was a Joker's rights plank, the first. The networks might call it a minor triumph for Hartman and the Jokers. The angry crowds out in the streets knew it meant nothing. With the platform set, the reasons for meeting Barnett were gone. "All but one," the interior voice was emphatic. "Do it." "Senator, if we just happened to be in the hall or something when he..." Worst of all, he'd had to deal with Puppet Man's increasing desperation since the incident outside. He'd tried, but had never managed to submerge the power again. Puppet Man was there, alongside him. People were noticing. Jackson certainly had. Ellen was staring at him when she thought he wasn't looking. Amy, Braun, Devon, all were handling him with obvious kid gloves. If he wanted this nomination, he had to do something about Puppet Man. He couldn't afford to have his attention divided so strongly. "Thanks, Billy. It sounds good. We have a few minutes? I'd like to freshen up." "Sure. I'll be up to get you." Greg hung up and went into the bathroom. He stared at the mirror. "You're out of control," he whispered. Gimli's cold amusement answered him. The day's efforts had cost him. The image that gazed back at him looked exhausted. "Barnett's for me," Puppet Man insisted again, and Greg almost expected to see his lips move with the words. "Once we take him as a puppet, we can maneuver him the way we did Gephardt and Babbitt, just a nudge here and there." "We were going to try that before, at one of the debates," Greg reminded him. "He always stayed away from us, never let us shake his hand or touch him at all. This is crazy." Puppet Man scoffed. "This time he will. You have to trust me. You can't win without my help." "But Gimli, we must try. If you stop fighting me, we can do it." "All right. All right." Billy Ray insisted on talking for the few minutes it took to go down to Barnett's floor. Greg let the monologue run unabated. He heard nothing of it. When the elevator doors opened, Ray stepped out, flashing his ID to speak with the guards posted there. Greg went to the edge of the balcony and stared down at the glittering lobby. A glider had landed on the carpet beside him. Mistral. He picked the toy up and gave it a gentle toss. It looped and then settled into a steady descent. Someone a few floors down saw it and gave a boozy cheer. 5 minutes later, an elevator chimed. Greg turned to see Lady Black step out, followed by Fleur and Leo Barnett. Greg put on a smile and strode forward. "Reverend Barnett, you are very well protected by your staff." Lady Black had stepped aside, but Fleur remained between Greg and Barnett, scowling and giving Greg no choice but to stop or run into her. He moved to one side and held out his hand to Barnett. Puppet Man hunched, ready to leap. Barnett was bluffly handsome, a fair-haired vision of the southern preacher. A faint smile lurked in his full lips, and the soft twang of his origins inhabited his resonant voice. "Senator Hartman, I'm sorry.
Sometimes my staff seems to think I need their protection as well as the Lord's, you understand. He looked at the proffered hand, and that faint smile crossed his mouth again. And I'd gladly shake your hand, Senator, but unfortunately mine's rather sore at the moment. A little mishap downstairs in the lobby. Puppet Man cursed. Greg pulled his hand back. Tell him that it was a joker, Reverend, Fleur snapped coldly. Tell him how you shook the sinner's hand and how he tried to crush it. I still think you should go to the hospital. A fracture. It's only a bruise, sister, please. Barnett smiled at Greg as if sharing some private joke. I'm sure the senator has had similar experiences. Handshaking's the bane of politicians. That it is, Greg said. He was so damn tired of smiling. He nodded to the stone-faced Fleur. And I'm especially sorry it was a joker. A joker with one of your campaign buttons, Fleur sniffed. Which my people, like yours, give out by the thousands, Greg countered a little too sharply. He turned to Barnett. There are enough misunderstandings already. I wanted to give you and your staff my congratulations on a hard fight over the platform, and to say that I'm glad we could finally come to a compromise. That made Barnett's lips twitch, and Greg knew he'd touched a nerve. I did not agree to the modified plank, Barnett said. There were, well, weak-hearted souls among my delegates who saw fit to accept it over my protest. It was a mistake, and I must confess my own vanity. I am sick over it. But the Lord also makes use of defeat, Senator. He's shown me that I was wrong trying to play these political games. I'm finding that this convention is hardly the place for someone like me. For a moment, Greg felt an uplift of optimism. If Barnett were to withdraw his nomination, even if he instructed his delegates to vote for Dukakis or Jackson. But Barnett was smiling again, taking out the well-worn Bible stuffed in his suit jacket's pocket and patting its gilded covers. I'm a man of God, Senator. For the remainder of this convention, I intend to do what I know best. I will pray. I will lock the doors of this world and open the doors of my soul. Greg's face must have shown his confusion. Today was hardly a defeat for you, Reverend, and hardly a victory for me. I'd like to work with you to make a new path, one both we and our party can follow. Isolating yourself isn't the answer. Barnett nodded seriously as if weighing Greg's argument in his mind. It might be that you're right, Senator. If so, then I have to trust that God will make it known to me. Still, I fully expect to spend the rest of this convention in prayer, and not in playing the convention power games. Fleur's well equipped to handle all that for the time being. I'm a stubborn fool sometimes. I don't really believe in compromise. I've no delusion that there is more than one right path. God I know and the God I've seen in the Bible doesn't compromise. God never came to understandings. God never made concessions to political realities. Barnett glanced at Greg, concern lining his high forehead. I don't mean to offend you, Senator, but I have to say what I believe. Yet, I believe in the very same God, Reverend. We're only men, not God himself. We do the best we can. We're not enemies. It's human pride that keeps us apart. The least we can do as leaders is shake hands and try to resolve our differences. Greg lathed his words with earnest conviction. For the good of all, that would seem to be the truly Christian act. Greg gave a bluff, self-deprecating chuckle and put out his hand once more. I promise not to squeeze. Puppet Man quivered in anticipation. For a moment, he was certain that it had worked. Barnett hesitated, rocking on his toes. Then the preacher thoughtfully clasped his hands together around his Bible. The act I'd like to see us share, Senator, is prayer. Let me make an invitation to you. Join me in my vigil. Let's leave the politics to the delegates and kneel together for the next several days. Reverend, Greg began. He shook his head.
Why does he avoid us every time?
Barnett nodded almost sadly. I thought not, he said. We walk very different paths, Senator. He began walking toward his room, clutching the Bible in his right hand. Greg let his hand drop to his side. You don't shake hands with enemies, Reverend? Greg's voice was harsh, tinged with puppet man's vitriol. Fleur, following behind Barnett, flushed angrily. Barnett simply favored Greg with another of his sorrowful, secretive smiles. People expect biblical quotes from a man of God, Senator, he said. It's not surprising, since the Bible often has just the right word for the occasion. One comes to mind now, from 1 Timothy. The Spirit distinctly says that in later times, some will turn away from the faith and will heed deceitful spirits and things taught by demons through plausible liars, men with seared consciences. Now that's a bit of hyperbole, Senator, but I think that, unbeknownst, perhaps, a demon taints your words. We're not enemies, Senator. At least I don't think so. And even if we were, I'd still pray that you'd come into the light and cleanse yourself. There's always hope for redemption. Always. Barnett gave Greg an unblinking long stare. There was a distinct click as he turned the deadbolt behind him.
The brandy kept hitting the cut on his lip, and each time it drew a yelp and a smirk from the bartender. Tachyon considered telling her to fuck off, and then he realized what a picture he must present. The mark of Sarah's nails from last night's fiasco lay like red furrows dug in the white skin of his cheek. His lower lip was split and slightly swollen from Fleur's nail. What a singularly unsuccessful Lothario he was. No wonder the young woman behind the bar smirked. Women, they always stuck together. Hi, mind if I join you? Josh Davidson slid onto the stool next to him. Tack turned to greet him with genuine pleasure. No, not at all. When a man sits huddled on a stool at a bar, it generally means he wants to be alone, but I thought I'd take a chance. I'm glad you did. Buy you a drink? Sure. An awkward silence fell between the two men, punctuated only by Davidson's order. Suddenly they shifted to face one another and both said in chorus, I've always admired you. They laughed. And Tachyon said, Well, isn't that convenient? We obviously have good taste. Tack paused and sipped brandy. Why are you down here? Davidson shrugged. Curiosity. About what? The political process? Can a man make a difference? No. Yes, I'm convinced of it. But you come from a culture that puts a premium on individual effort, said Davidson, rolling his glass between his palms. I take it you don't agree. I don't know. It seems a questionable proposition to allow one man's vision, opinion, to shape policy. But in this political system, it never happens. Even in my aristocratic culture, the absolute despot is a fantasy. There are always competing interests. Yes, so how do you choose between them? Frowning, Tachyon said, You make the decision. That sounds so easy. But what right do you have to substitute your judgment for the will of the people? Suggested the Takesian. Yes. Tachyon steepled his fingers before his mouth, threw back his head, and regarded the wine glasses hanging like crystal stalactites from their rack. A representative owes the people not only his industry, but his judgment, and he betrays them if he sacrifices it to their opinion. Edmund Burke. Davidson's laughter was sharp and clear. Tachyon stiffened. Doctor, you astound me. Tachyon didn't reply. He knew he astounded people. He had astounded people since the moment of his arrival on this planet, August 23rd, 1946. Ideal. Where had the time gone? 42 years. He had lived almost as long on this world as his own. Home. Hello? Where are you? Dark, thoughtful eyes, soft with concern. On a world that doesn't exist for me anymore. Homesickness lay like a jagged lump in the back of Tack's throat. So minutes, hours, days, weeks, months, and years passed over to the end they were created, would bring white hairs unto a quiet grave. Ah, what a life were this, how sweet, how lovely. Gives not the hawthorn bush a sweeter shade to shepherds, looking on their silly sheep, than doth a rich embroidered canopy to kings that fear their subjects' treachery? The men's eyes locked. Doesn't that describe Tacky's? Asked Davidson softly. And Earth. Treachery may be the one constant in an inconstant universe. Tack rose abruptly. Pray excuse me. You were right. I do need to be alone.
11 p.m. The day had been a total washout. Spectre sprawled on the bed, two pillows propping him up. He had the TV remote control in one hand and a bottle of whiskey in the other. It was his bedtime ritual and helped him feel less out of place. He wasn't going to get to Hartman in this building, not unless he was lucky beyond belief. And he'd used up his luck in getting this far. He didn't have access to the areas of the hotel that Hartman would be in, except during press conferences. And he'd noticed that politicians rarely looked you in the eye unless you asked them a question. He wasn't dumb enough to draw that kind of attention to himself. He sipped at his drink and played channel roulette. Atlanta had gotten pounded again, this time by the Cardinals. The news was full of political bullshit, of course. Was Hartman porking the stupid reporter bitch? Did Leo Barnett really think God spoke to him? Spectre wished he'd gotten contracts to kill them all. Politicians were mostly people who'd had too little morals and ethics to stay lawyers. He'd eventually settled on an old movie. It was a period piece set in France during the Revolution. There was a guy in it who talked like Odie Cologne from the King Leonardo cartoons. Spectre thought the actor had a double role, but hadn't been paying close enough attention to be sure. None of the colors looked like anything that occurred in nature, just pastels that blurred and bled into each other anytime someone moved. Ted Turner's movies looked about as good as his baseball team. It had been weird running into Tony, even weirder finding out that he was a honcho for Hartman. Tony was a good guy, and Spectre liked him. But he'd always been something of a bleeding heart. The actor was in deep shit now, headed for the guillotine. He didn't seem particularly upset about it. Spectre would have gone kicking and screaming. He knew what it was like to die. He could use Tony to get at Hartman, if there was no other way. Spectre had always prided himself on the fact that he never fucked over his friends. He'd never had many, so it wasn't that hard to do. But the job came first. The actor had just sent a little blonde number up to the big blade with a kiss, and now it was his turn. It's a far, far better thing I do than I have ever done before. It's a far, far better rest I go to than I have ever known. The actor stood before the guillotine, noble, unafraid. Naturally, the camera pans up so nobody can see his head flop into the basket. What a fucking sap, Spectre said, as he zapped the TV off. He downed another slug of whiskey and turned off the lights.
Chapter 3, Wednesday, July 20th, 1988. 7 a.m. The heavy thrum of the engines ran through every nerve. Takian stared gloomily out the plane's window, until returned to the present by a dig in the ribs from his seat companion. The stewardess indicated the covered tray with her eyes and raised her eyebrows.
Thank you, no, but I would like a drink, a screwdriver. Put that orange juice to good use.
He smiled at her. She didn't respond. In fact, she gave him a look that clearly said, "You lush." He returned to his moody contemplation of the boiling thunderheads 2,000 feet below. The stewardess returned with his drink, and Tack dug into his pocket for money. He came up with an inch-thick pile of pink message slips.
Takian, call me, goddammit! Hiram!
He got the woman paid and stared again at Hiram's insulting and uncommunicative message.
What the fuck did Worcester want? And what the fuck had Davidson meant?
Did he mean to imply that Takian was a shepherd and the Joker's silly sheep? Or was the reference to a king meant for him? Or had it held a more personal meaning? Davidson had looked odd. Or was it just an irritating affectation on the part of a professional actor who couldn't carry on a conversation without a scriptwriter?
Silly sheep. God damn him.
Tack pulled out a handkerchief and gave his nose a quick blow.
I'm going home to bury one of my lost sheep. Oh, chrysalis.
He propped his head on his hand.
9 a.m. He'd had to wait almost 45 minutes to get seated. The Atrium coffee shop was a blur of activity. Wait persons bounced around from table to table like pinballs. Spectre sat by himself in a small booth, ignoring the babble of everyone around him. He looked slowly around the room. There were lots of red-rimmed eyes and pained expressions. Spectre figured most of them had gotten fucked up or fucked or both last night. He hadn't managed much sleep himself until the early morning hours. A waitress stopped at his table and made a face that might have been a smile. The first 1,000 or so times she'd done it. She pulled out her pad and pencil and raised her eyebrows expectantly.
What can I get for you this morning, sir?
The words came out in swift, staccato fashion. So much for Southern hospitality. Just coffee for now. Spectre smiled slowly. He wanted food, too, but figured he was going to get his money's worth out of this bitch. The waitress gave him a dirty look and shot away from the table. Spectre leaned back in his chair and forced his surroundings to go out of focus. He had to come up with a plan to get at Hartman. The pain was chewing at him big time this morning, making it hard to think. Maybe he could get some inside dope from Tony. Find out where and when the senator would be most exposed. It would have to be crowded enough that nobody would realize exactly what had happened. At least not for a while. The waitress swept back over and set his coffee down hard, slopping it over into the saucer.
Sorry, she said, clearly not meaning it. Will there be anything else?
Spectre waited a long moment before replying. I'll need just a few more minutes. The waitress rolled her eyes and walked away. Spectre picked up his cup and took a large swallow. The coffee burned his mouth and throat going down. No problem. It would heal before he decided what to order. He'd never have blisters on his tongue again. Spectre glanced over at the line of people waiting to be seated. A trim, bearded, older man walked past the crowd and looked slowly around the room. The man saw Spectre and began walking purposefully over to his table. Spectre tensed his legs, ready to bolt up if necessary. The man looked familiar somehow. He stopped at the other side of the table and smiled.
Pardon me. It's rather crowded in here this morning. Do you mind if I join you? My name is Josh Davidson. Spectre was about to tell him to fuck off, when he remembered that Davidson was one of his favorite actors. All the tension went out of him when Davidson smiled again. No, please, sit down, Mr. Davidson. Spectre handed the actor his menu and looked for the waitress. He was damned if Josh Davidson was gonna have to wait for service if he could do anything about it. Thank you so much, Davidson said, carefully seating himself. He pulled a folded newspaper out from under his arm and opened it up. Spectre spotted the waitress and was about to signal her when a large man emerged from the crowd. Hiram Worcester smoothed the creases in his lapels and looked from table to table. Mind if I read a section? Spectre reached for the front page, which Davidson had set aside. Be my guest. Spectre grabbed the paper and opened it quickly. He peeped up over the top. Fat Man was still looking about. If he's looking for Davidson, I'm sunk, he thought. As satisfying as it might be to croak the blimpy bastard, he couldn't jeopardize the job. A waiter walked over to Worcester and nodded deferentially. I have to leave, Mr. Davidson, Spectre said. Not really feeling too well. Mind if I keep your front page? Not at all. It's the least I can do. Spectre stood and walked slowly toward the door, keeping the newspaper raised in front of him. It looked stupid, but was better than having Worcester recognize him. The waitress walked past him as he left. Good riddance, she said, just loud enough for him to hear. Spectre was too preoccupied to even care.
11 a.m. Takian leaned against the side of the pew and licked sweat from his upper lip. He was afraid he was going to faint from the stifling heat, and the four enormous fans at the back of Our Lady of the Perpetual Misery did little to stir the heavy, moist air. He considered removing his velvet coat, but that would reveal the sweat-darkened circles beneath his armpits, and what an offensive state in which to say farewell to Chrysalis. He was supposed to verbalize that farewell, sum up in brilliant, poignant words what Chrysalis had meant to Jokertown, and he had no idea what he was going to say. He hadn't really known Chrysalis, and on some level, he hadn't really liked her. But one could scarcely say that in a eulogy. Staring at her flower-draped casket, Tak wondered if Chrysalis's ghost was hovering nearby, listening to the hurried mumbling as the Living Rosary Society told their beads and offered prayers for the repose of her soul. The procession began, led by a Joker altar boy with a bronze helix hung with a Joker Jesus. He was followed by two others swinging censers that sent clouds of incense into the already highly redolent air. Tak coughed, covered his mouth with his handkerchief. I hate all this Catholic mumbo-jumbo. She was raised a Baptist, and she should have died a Baptist. Tak turned his head slowly and regarded the man seated next to him in the pew. He was a big man, with a weathered face that was florid beneath his tan. The black suit coat strained across his belly, and tendrils of sweat left shiny lines on his jowls. There didn't seem to be anything to say, so Tak didn't. I'm Joe Jory, Deborah Joe's daddy. How do you do? Tak mumbled as Father Squid, resplendent in his finest surplice, walked past with ponderous dignity. The priest reached the altar, set his missal in place, then turned to the crowd and raised his arms wide, saying in his sad, soft voice, Let us pray. Throughout the Mass, Jory and Takian struggled along, always a beat behind the standing, kneeling, sitting worshippers. Last year it had been the same situation at Dez's funeral, and in that moment Takian knew what he was going to say in the eulogy. He stopped trying to make sense of the alien ceremony and simply sat with head bowed, tears
slipping slowly from beneath closed lids as he composed his thoughts. The little Joker altar boy nudged his shoulder, and Tack returned from his reverie. A hamper containing tiny loaves of bread. The Dakishan broke off a bite and passed on the hamper. The bread seemed to swell in his dry mouth, and he choked, trying to get it down. With a quick, surreptitious glance to either side, he unlimbered his flask and gulped down a sip of brandy. Father Squid beckoned, and Tack took his place at the lectern. Pulling out his handkerchief, he wiped his face, drew a deep breath, and began. Exactly 1 year ago, on the 20th day of July, 1987, we gathered in this church to bury Xavier Desmond. I spoke his eulogies, I shall speak Chrysalis's, and I am honored to do so, but the melancholy truth is that I am weary of burying my friends. Joker Town is a poorer place because of their passing, and my life and yours is diminished by their loss. Tack paused and stared down at his hands where they gripped the lectern. He forced himself to relax. A eulogy is a speech in praise of a person, but I am finding this one to be very difficult. I called myself Chrysalis's friend. I saw her frequently. I even traveled around the world with her, but I realize now that I didn't really know her. I knew she called herself Chrysalis, and that she lived in Joker Town, but I didn't know her natal name or where she'd been born. I knew she played at being British, but I never knew why. I knew she liked to drink amaretto, but I never knew what made her laugh. I knew she liked secrets, liked to be in control, liked to appear cool and untouched, but I never knew what made her that way. I thought about all of this on the plane from Atlanta and decided that if I couldn't speak in praise of her, at least I could speak in praise of her deeds. A year ago, when war raged in our streets and our children were in danger, Chrysalis offered her place, her palace, as a refuge and fortress. It was dangerous for her, but danger never disturbed Chrysalis. She was a joker who refused to act like a joker. The Crystal Lady never wore a mask. You took her as you found her, or you could just be damned. In this way, perhaps she taught some gnats tolerance and some jokers courage. Tears were streaming down his face. In order to speak past the lump in his throat, he pushed his voice higher and louder. Because we worship our ancestors, Takesian funerals are even more important than births. We believe our dead stay close by to guide their foolish descendants, a belief that can be terrifying or comforting, depending on the personality of the ancestor. Chrysalis's presence, I think, will be more terrifying than comforting, because she will require much of us. Someone murdered her. This should not go unpunished. Hate rises like a smothering tide in this country. We must resist it. Our neighbors are poor and hungry, frightened and destitute. We must feed and shelter and comfort and aid them. She will expect all of this from us. Takian paused and scanned the congregation. His attention was drawn to the bank of votive candles burning near the lectern. Crossing to it, he lifted one of the tiny candles and returned to the lectern. The flame flickered hypnotically before his eyes. In 1 year, Joker Town has lost two of its most important leaders. We are frightened and saddened and confused by the loss. But I say they are
still here, still with us. Let us be worthy of them, win honor in their memories. Never forget. Bending, Tack pulled his knife from its boot sheath. He placed the candle on the lectern and positioned his forefinger directly over the flame. With a quick slash, he cut his finger and extinguished the flame with a drop of his blood. Farewell, Chrysalis.
Running into Fat Man had rattled him a bit, but a couple swallows of whiskey had helped calm Spectre down. He sat hunched over the edge of the bed, staring at the headline. Hartman to speak in park today. The senator was going to make a public plea to the Jokers to demonstrate in a non-violent manner. It was risky, what with all the lunatics wandering around. No one was crazier than a politician with his back to the wall, though, and Hartman was really up against it. Spectre turned on the TV and tuned it to a channel that showed the times and places of the day's events. After a few moments waiting, there it was, a 1 o'clock speech, and nothing about any cancellation. Spectre chewed his lip and paged through the paper absent-mindedly. He needed an angle. He'd need a way to blend into the crowd and still stand out enough to manage to catch Hartman's eye. A small corner ad caught his attention. It was Keaton's costumes. Masks, makeup, costumes, party supplies, and more, it promised. A man in a costume held up the list and smiled in a stupid, exaggerated way. He looked like Marcel Marceau. Spectre tossed the paper, wiped the ink stains off on his gray pants, and started laughing.
Jack passed through the enormous brass revolving door into the Marriott lobby, saw the swarms of press and Hartman delegates, and tried not to think of pigs at a trough. The campaign was doing its best to feed its people and get everyone back onto the floor in the short time allowed by the luncheon recess. And the Marriott had obliged with a vast buffet that was serving up pasta salad and rare roast beef by the ton. Jack could see Hiram Worcester perched on a sagging sofa near the lounge piano, a plate piled high with food balanced on either knee. The glass elevators were jammed full of press and delegates taking hookers up to their rooms for a little noon relief. The piano man was playing Piano Man once again. Jack had an oppressive feeling he knew precisely what song was going to come.